alternative dispute resolution provider that you are subscribed to. Who is it? They'll tell you. And take your claim there. And if the facts are, as you've explained to me this evening, I'm sure they are, you will be awarded compensation and your associated expenses. Good luck with that. Let me know what happens. I think you'll find that will be a success. Thank you very much for your calls, text and tweets this evening. That's it from me, consumer lawyer Dean Dunham. A quick reminder that the advice offered in this hour is for guidance only. You should always seek your own independent legal opinion. I'll be back next Sunday, 9 p.m. with another LBC Consumer Hour. In the meantime, if you missed any of tonight's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date with all the latest news and opinion, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. Download the all-new official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 1, it's Richard Spur, but next here on LBC, it's Nick Abbott.
Thank you, Dean. A packed programme tonight. We will look at who tops the Sunday Times taxpayer list and whether they really are paying that much, all things considered. Cyclists get a bad press, but do they deserve it? And given the health benefits, are we even remotely a cycle-friendly country? The leader of the Green Party says drugs should be legalised and people should be allowed to have a good time on whatever they want. Is there any point in continuing the war on drugs? We'll hear the latest on Iran, check in with our US correspondent, and get a weather forecast as we head into the last month of winter. But first, Keir Starmer tells Andrew Windsor he should testify to the Epstein Committee. But would anything come of it if he did? That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, President Trump says he's hoping to reach an agreement with Iran over its nuclear program. He's been speaking after warnings from the country's supreme leader any U.S. military strike would cause a regional war. A major buildup of Washington's forces has developed in the Gulf area, but the Middle East analyst Laura Blumenfeld has been telling LBC President Trump considers the Iranian people to be allies.
It's very important, as Trump's deliberating what to do next, to send a message to the Iranian people. No, they can't blow out the regime, but the Iranian people can. So any kind of even limited strike would send a message. So much of this is personal for Donald Trump. He likes Iranians. He's grown up with them, whether it was in Queens or just making business deals. And that's really important.
The Prime Minister says the UK will look into working with the EU on defence. Sir Keir Starmer says it may apply to join a multi-billion euro fund for military projects. The European Commission is considering the launch of a second edition of its Safe Loans scheme. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor is facing new calls to testify before Congress in Washington over his links with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Sir Keir Starmer says a victim-centred approach is needed and the former prince should now share information. Andrew has always denied any wrongdoing. David Smith from The Guardian's Washington Bureau has been telling LBC some people in the US still want more information about Epstein.
Democrats feel we still don't have everything. They're saying, look, we've got maybe 3 million pages here, but that's only half, and there's another 3 million to go. And yet Todd Blanche, the Deputy Attorney General, has been on the Sunday politics shows in America saying the case is over.
More on this in the next half hour with Nick Abbott here on LBC. Russia's being accused of launching a drone strike which killed a dozen mine workers in Ukraine. Seven other people were injured while returning from a shift in the city of Terenivka in the southeast of the country. The mayor of Portland, Oregon, has demanded U.S. immigration officials leave the city after federal agents used tear gas against demonstrators. They included young children and had gathered outside ICE premises. Keith Wilson has described the event as peaceful. And in sport this evening, the Premier League leaders Arsenal say Mikel Merino will be out of action for an extended period because of an injury. He's facing surgery on his right foot after being hurt during last Sunday's match against Manchester United. LBC weather, cloudy with rain clearing to the southeast overnight. There'll be clear spells in Wales, the southwest and Northern Ireland, which could lead to some ice forming. There'll be a low of around 3 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. Keir Starmer said that Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor will be failing victims if he continues to refuse to testify about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. The PM urged the former prince to give evidence before a US congressional committee that first requested his testimony in November last. Let's talk about this with Deborah Blum. Deborah is a New York-based attorney and joins us on the line now. Good evening, Deborah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I appreciate your time. A congressional committee is not a trial, is it? But would there be any punishment for lying if Andrew did actually go to speak to it?
Well, there could be, but, you know, also it's a question of, if I was his attorney, I would say that he still had sovereign immunity, because during the time that he would be testifying to, he was a royal. So I also, as an attorney, would absolutely advise him not to testify in front of Congress. He's not an American citizen. And to the best of my knowledge, he does not have a duty to do so. So I don't think that there would be the same implications to him if a subpoena was issued as there would be to an American citizen. You know, it's rumored that Meghan Markle spent time on Epstein's yacht with then Prince Andrew. So a lot is coming out about him that really shows why they stripped him of his royal title.
Yes, I mean, he is not immune to the law as his as the king, who can't be charged with any crime, as far as I'm aware. That does not apply to Prince Andrew, so he couldn't claim royal immunity, because I don't think the immunity climbs that far down the scale.
Well, there are statutes that support children of royalty having the same privilege. So as an attorney, you of course would try to seek for that privilege to apply. And he's not an American citizen. I would just tell him not to come. I mean, he did such a bad job during his BBC interview saying that he cut off his relationship at a certain time, and now the documents are showing that that's not true.
But there's a question of PR in this, isn't there? I mean, it'd be probably safer for him not to show up, but the sort of ramifications as far as the public's opinion of him and the royal family in general would plummet, perhaps, if he didn't.
I disagree. I think that the royal family would absolutely want to stop him from doing so. He made a fool of himself, respectfully, when he spoke on the BBC. It's not in his interest to be subjected to questioning. And I don't think that the Department of Justice is interested in having any prosecutions result from this. I think that they want to move forward and move past this. A lot of the things that are coming out aren't criminal. I mean, we know that with your Peter Mandelson, that could be something that's criminal, because supposedly he sent $75,000 or received $75,000 from Jeffrey Epstein, and it wasn't reported, and he was a member of your government at that time. So in terms of illegal things with Americans, that could be prosecuted, but a lot of it is just salacious information. To the extent that there's proof of individuals being with underage victims, then that's a different story.
Yeah, in America, the bodies that are supposedly investigating Epstein's crimes, the Department of Justice, the FBI, the CIA, correct me if I get anything wrong, they've been hollowed out and refilled with Donald Trump's quislings to further the interests of Donald Trump. I mean, they seem to be being used as weapons to attack people that Trump doesn't like and to provide distraction from Trump's own appearance in the Epstein files. Can we trust them not to use a big name like Andrew to further Trump's interests? Because, I mean, if Russia was demanding Andrew go there and give testimony, we wouldn't even entertain the idea.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, they are attorneys, so we're subject to ethical obligations, and most attorneys don't take that lightly and are not going to do something that would jeopardize their license to protect someone. So it would be my hope that the members of the Department of Justice, my general belief that they're doing what they're supposed to do. They released the documents, which I believe they were ordered to. I'd have to confirm that. And it seems that a lot of their resources have gone towards complying with the release of these documents. But, yeah. You know, I hear what you're saying. It's just, as an attorney, you don't have a loyalty to the president. You have a loyalty to the bar
Theoretically, yes.
Yeah.
How confident are you that the documents that have been released have not been combed through for evidence that implicates certain individuals?
Look, anything is possible, right? I mean, you could redact something. I, as a defense attorney, I receive redacted documents all the time, and you never know what's redacted. You can generally put it together what it's supposed to be, but if things are redacted, I'm sure that the other side, the, you know, the Democrats that are hell-bent on pushing this, you know, but this is something that actually went across both sides of the aisle. So I don't view this as a Republican-Democrat thing. People on both sides are a part of this. That, you know, the records show and support that. So
Trump sees it.
I don't think we're ever going to know.
Trump sees it as a political thing, though, doesn't he? He's always talking about the Epstein scam and that it's a political plot to try and bring him down, and you know, that he has, that he never met, he doesn't know the guy, he never met the guy, and all of the rest of that.
Yeah, well, that's certainly you know, the evidence shows that he knew him and, right, was phonographed with him, so on and so forth. No, all of this is political. It really, I think, is distracting from what we should really be focusing on. There are some really major issues happening in our world. People are being senselessly killed in Iran, and that should be a focus, in my opinion.
So do you think that actually this committee is wasting its time, that these crimes happened so long ago, the main perpetrator is dead now, his accomplice is in prison, and we should move on?
Well, I think that if there are underage victims who they haven't prosecuted for, that I would fully believe is a good use of the resources of the United States of America. But there are certainly other issues that the Department of Justice should focus on. So I think that it's a resource balancing and what needs to be the focus and how to best move America forward towards being a better place.
But it's all about attention now, isn't it? I mean, over and above what we're talking about, it seems to be trying to distract people from whatever it is that is inconvenient at that moment to the regime. Do you think that this is being used as a major distraction because it is so very fascinating? I mean, apart from anything else, there's all these famous names that we know, the rich and shameless, that keep cropping up all the time.
You know, I think Trump seems to want to leave it behind him, right? So I don't think that it's he himself who personally wants to move this forward. It could be the fact that he was involved in some way, not that I'm saying he was, right? But I don't think it's in his interest to push this forward. So I think it's being used as a chip by the Democrats to demand this information, even though it's not going to help all their friends either. So yeah, I do think that this is somewhat of a it's just like a circus.
If they did continue with this, do you think that there is anything that any witness would be able to tell them that cannot already be found by just combing through the files? I mean, they're talking about 3 million files. I can't even imagine what that would look like if you printed it out. It would fill the east wing of the...
You're gonna have a log of, like, you know, like, I think that what's illegal, right? It's not illegal for Prince Andrew to email about being introduced to a 26-year-old beautiful Russian woman. That's not illegal. What's illegal would be if it involved minors. So from what I have seen, we don't see proof or evidence of what actually happened. I mean, it's definitely hinted at, but unless it's hard proof, it's simply not. And I think that the victims have come forward, and perhaps they'll seek further prosecution, and then that's something that our justice system should do, because children should not be subjected to that kind of behavior.
Do you think that the other big names that are associated, the ones that keep cropping up all the time, that they are too big to fall? I mean, billionaires don't often go to jail, and even if they did, Trump seems to act like a pardoning machine. Insert the correct amount and you're out.
Yeah, well, the administration is not pardoning any sex crimes. So to the extent that, you know, you spoke about the attorneys for the White House, Susie Weil, who's part of the staff, is not allowing for commutations or pardons of sex criminals. So I don't know that these individuals, if it came out that they had illegal, illicit relations with children, I'm not sure that they would receive a pardon or a commutation.
In an ideal world, what do you think should happen next?
You know, in my ideal world, I think that we should move on. I think that there's really a lot going on in this world that requires attention. And I think it was a different time that does not condone the behavior in any way, shape, or form. This shines a light on the rich and powerful. The mayor of New York City was on the island, right? I think it's like a who's who was there. So to spend all of our resources going after these individuals when it's so far in time and certain evidence that may exonerate them doesn't exist, you know, it's very difficult to go backwards in time and have a prosecution.
Good to talk to you, Deborah. Thanks so much for that. Deborah Blum, New York-based attorney, talking about the prospect of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor going to give evidence before a U.S. congressional committee. Deborah thinks that we should, we should move on. What do you think? 0345 6060 973.
This is LBC.
And when teams feel supported, they can achieve anything.
Sorry, just had even more of my team are off ill.
Have you tried Benenden Health? It's easy to set up. They've got a GP helpline you can book 24/7.
Where were we?
A coffee break, hopefully.
Press play on your people's health with a wide range of healthcare services for less than £16 per employee per month. Search Benenden for Business. Fee reviewed periodically. T's and C's apply. Qualifying periods apply for some services. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
They say, go big or go home. But now you can go big at home with the Big Arch on delivery. That's right, the Big Arch is back and it's here to stay. Big Arch, for big McDonald's hunger. Order in the McDonald's app. Serve from 11 a.m. 18 plus. Service fee and small order fee may apply. Upcharges apply to delivery orders. Subject to availability, price and participation may vary.
I'm Leah and this is my NHS story. I could just feel my body didn't feel right. And my GP referred me to the CDC. Had some blood tests done and within 24 hours I had my results. And that just reassured me that I was being taken seriously.
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. So the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS Fit for the Future. Available England wide.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So Keir Starmer has registered an opinion on this. It gets increasingly stern as time moves on. And now his position is that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor will be failing victims if he continues to refuse to testify about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. But if you were him, would you go and testify? The Prime Minister urged the former prince to give evidence before a US congressional committee that first requested his testimony in November. Now, they've got about 3 million files, which is an unimaginably large amount of information. Can there really be anything that he can share that they don't know already? And there's a new tranche of file, a million or so, as far as I'm aware, that have just been released, which suggest that Andrew invited Epstein to Buckingham Palace shortly after Epstein finished serving his sentence in 2010, and then later in the year offered him an investment opportunity in Afghanistan, about which we don't know anything because that's one of the things that has been redacted from these documents, which also suggests that Epstein arranged a dinner in August 2010 between Andrew and a 26-year-old Russian woman, which is not a crime, of course. Do you think that part of this is the public's salacious interest in any story that's got to do with sex, particularly a story that's got to do with sex and rich people, and extra particularly has got to do with sex and rich people and famous people, because there's no end of famous people that have been orbiting Jeffrey Epstein. I guess the rich do attract other rich people like magnets. And, of course, just because their name appears on this list does not indicate any untoward actions on their part. Andrew in Saltburn says, how in the name of all that is holy were cameras allowed in Epstein's evil lair? For men of their positions, you would think they'd have more sense, dumb as well as sleazy. Well, yeah, and again, it's not against the law to be dumb, but it does seem, it does seem to indicate a certain sense of entitlement that perhaps some of them knew that they were doing something wrong. You would have to think that at least some of these people had a conscience, but they couldn't contemplate the notion of being caught doing it. Now, a lot of the cameras seem to have been hidden cameras, and why he hid cameras around his evil island and his Manhattan townhouse, well, there's all sorts of theories running around about that. Could be for reasons of extortion, or it could be a compromise, and the Russians could be behind it. And there's no end of questions, and it is a fascinating story, as well as being awful. You had to sort of remind yourself that these were actual, real people who were being abused in this way. But Deborah Blum, the New York-based attorney that I was just speaking to, thinks that it was a long time ago. All of the evidence that could either exonerate or commit these people of these crimes is long disappeared, and that there are other more important things in the world and that we should all just move on. Now, that would probably be echoed by all of the people whose names appear in these files. What do you think about that? 0345-6060-973. Hereford, Heather.
Yes, hello to you.
Heather.
I hope your cold gets better.
Oh, thanks.
Yes, I think we're all in stuffy atmospheres and that's what causes it.
No doubt.
Yes. Anyway, I want to say I don't understand how these women can say they are victims all the time, because if they didn't like it, if it was me, I'd jump out of the window and into a taxi and you wouldn't see me for dust.
But what if you were on an island?
Well, yes, then you could say you were like a prisoner, maybe. But surely they knew where they were headed.
Right.
Like, I don't.
So your position is that the girls who are the victims in this case should have known better.
Well, I'm saying it's a possibility. I mean, it depends, because, like, they could have been younger and innocent and tricked into nefarious things.
Yeah.
But even so, there must have come a time when they said, well, this is just not me and I'm off, you know? And if not, why speak up now after all this time has passed? I think it's just to go to court to ask for compensation.
But you must have heard of people who have been, if not kidnapped exactly, then sort of held by their captors, and they've told themselves to go, but they fear for the consequences of doing that, because they're dealing with very, very powerful and rich men who have an enormous amount of resources to to go after them. There must have been some fear in these girls' minds.
They have to speak in court and prove their case truthfully, you know, and corroborate all this, you know. Not just, we can't just say they're victims all the time. You know, the questions lawyers can ask to get the truth in a proper manner.
Right, that's it, precisely what is the committee is trying to get to find the evidence they need to further prosecute whoever might be worthy of their attention. Yes, but that's an interesting take, Heather, that it's the victims themselves that perhaps should have known better and got out of there sooner. I haven't heard that before. But thanks, Heather. Appreciate that. 0345 6060 973. Are we at the point of victim blaming now? I suppose we were going to get there eventually. Has it happened already? Has it actually been the case that we're blaming victims and I just hadn't noticed all this time? 0345 60 60 973. Fife. Hello, David.
Hi there. I just need to say, Andrew is now finished, right? How far do we need to push him down? What about all the other people? Okay, we've got a picture of him hovering over a woman. Is she drugged up? Is she drunk? Who knows? Don't care. Didn't see her face. But there's all these other people who are also were involved. All this, I mean, was Trump involved? Was Tom Hanks involved? All the other people who could have been. Why is it all to do with Andrew, you know?
Well, because he's the, as far as the British press are concerned, he's the biggest name on that list.
But what about the Americans?
Well, I'm sure that in America, that Prince Andrew's name is not toppermost of the stories on this issue. I'm sure that, you know, the other people that you've mentioned and some of the, you know, tech billionaires and
no,
so on.
No, I mean, it's all kind of, can't prove anything, but why are we pushing Andrew all the time?
Because he's a member of the royal family, he is expected to, as the other members of the royal family are, to act in a way that brings pride and positivity to this country, not to, you know, envelop the country in a sort of a sense of shame.
So what about certain philanthropists, like, you know, Microsoft guy who got a sexually transmitted disease?
Well, that's the accusation, which he has vigorously denied.
Yeah, I know, but it just seems to be all about Andrew, you know. I mean, I don't care about Andrew. Andrew's done now. I think we just leave him alone. He's finished, you know.
Well, I'm sure that for the rest of his life, he will be living a particularly comfortable life, the likes of which that you and I could only dream of, David. I think
he might not be.
My money is on him doing just fine.
Well, maybe yeah, possibly. Yeah.
All right, but okay. So we seemed if it was a scorecard. It's very heavily weighted on the let's just forget it and move on, which kind of surprises me because. Unless I'm wrong, the British press are obsessed with stories about paedophilia. I mean, usually it's got something to do with their take on immigration. They do tend to pick and choose the immigration stories or the attacks of, you know, a sexual nature, dependent on who is doing it. If it's a white 50-year-old man that was born here, then they're not that interested. If it was an immigrant who's just got off a dinghy, then it's front-page news for a week. But it's the sex part that that creates the interest. And so for a country that seems utterly obsessed with sex, particularly accusing people of being a paedophile, it seems a bit weird that so far, as I said, if this was a scorecard, it's gone down heavily in favour of forgetting all about it. I did not expect that. 0345 6060 973. Egham, hello, Tobin.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I think it's absolutely abhorrent that you've got a lawyer and you've got two other fully grown adults calling into the show, and it almost sounds like they're trying to excuse it. You know, they're saying, oh, well, we should just move on. These people who are involved in the very top level of our country are involved in sex trafficking, and they're involved in, you know, paedophilia and rape of young, and people keep saying these young women, they're not young women, they're children, but they're girls. These are really heinous sex crimes that really need to be investigated, I think.
Yes, the lawyer's point was that it's all happened a very long time ago, and there's precious little evidence left that could lead to people's conviction.
I mean, absolutely. You know, I don't think there's any question over whether people will be able to prosecute people for every single crime. But when this type of thing is going on in the top bands, that kind of elite level in our politics and our royal family, and you see that there's no way that this will have just stopped. It didn't just stop when these Epstein files stopped. You know, this will be a continue. It's a culture. And if there's a culture of it, we need to look what else is going on, who else is still doing things like this. I mean, the President of the United States is involved in something like this. And as you said earlier, he seems to be on this pardoning spree and just letting people away with everything. And it's really important that we fight against this and make sure that justice is served for these victims who were at the time
Well, yes.
40 years old.
But to be clear, when you say involved, you mean that they, these people whose names that we are familiar with, they were in Jeffrey Epstein's orbit. To say, to conclude that just because they knew him or were pictured in his company or hung out with him, that they had anything to do with the crimes that we're talking about would be incorrect. I mean, there's absolutely no suggestion that anyone named here has done anything wrong, unless proven otherwise. And so far, that is not the case, apart from with two people, one of whom is dead. I should let you know, by the way, that Lord Manderson has resigned his membership from the Labour Party. He says he does not wish to cause further embarrassment to the party over his links to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Earlier, it emerged that documents appeared to show that Manderson, the former British ambassador to Washington, was paid $75,000 by Epstein. Mandelson said he had no record and no recollection of ever receiving these sums. Now, I'll come back to your thoughts on this issue after a news break. We're also going to check in on the situation in Iran. Iran's leader has warned the US that an attack would ignite a regional war. We'll have more details on that after the news headlines with Tim Daly.
In the last few minutes, Lord Peter Mandelson says he's resigned his membership of the Labour Party following further revelations about his friendship with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. He says he wants to avoid causing it any further embarrassment. President Trump has responded to warnings about regional stability from Iran's supreme leader by saying he hopes to reach an agreement with Tehran. The two nations are at odds over the Gulf state's nuclear program. And the Prime Minister says the UK will look into working with the EU on defence. Sir Keir Starmer says it may apply to join a multi-billion euro fund for military projects. LBC weather, cloudy with rain clearing to the southeast overnight, clear for Wales, the southwest and Northern Ireland, and a possibility of icy patches. We'll see a low of around 3 degrees.
LBC.
Everything breakfast at Ocado. Save on yogurt, cereal, and get a great price on milk, so you can splurge on eggs, even from quails. Perfect if you have the urge to eat a dozen eggs, but you aren't that hungry. Save and splurge at Ocado, the online supermarket. Select lines only, geographical restrictions, minimum spend and charges apply. Offers end 24th of Feb. Terms and offer info at ocado.com/terms.
Sunlight's guaranteed over 50 plan gave confidence to Jane and Chris. With their insurance sorted, they're becoming tourists, cutting loose in their birthday suits, feeling elegant and free. But when they answered the door, the postman saw more than he expected to see. Sunlight, a little confidence goes a long way. Affordable cover with a cash payout. Search Sunlight Cover today.
Premiums paid could exceed the payment. Full cover after 1 year. Ages 49 to 85.
With over 50 years' experience at Fidelity, we believe there's a difference between investing and being invested. Investing is having access to guidance, tools and expert insights. Being invested means feeling confident about your future. Investing is choosing from a wealth of investment options. Being invested means focusing on your long-term goals. For ISAs, pensions or advice, be truly invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Terms apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Yes, you can call 0345 6060973. If you want to text, it's 84850. Email nicka@lbc.co.uk. And if you are on WhatsApp, then it is the same number as the phone, 0345 6060973. We are trying to get hold of a former senior advisor at the US State Department to talk us through what is happening in Iran at the moment. But in the meantime, let's take more calls about your thoughts on the ex-Prince Andrew situation. King's Lynn, hello, Sharon.
Hello. Well, for a start, I can't understand why everybody is kind of happy for it all to just be brushed under the carpet. But I'm also quite... I mean, it seems to be that if it's paedophilia, then people are quite happy for an investigation. But what they're not getting, in my opinion, is the fact that these women are trafficked. They're still vulnerable women, and the age really shouldn't make any difference. Trafficking people is a crime.
Yes.
Sexploitation is a crime.
Exactly.
And he was involved in it. So,
well, we don't know that he was involved in it. We know that he was friends with Jeffrey Epstein, but what we don't know is how far that friendship went and what his involvement in Epstein's nefarious activities amounted to.
true, but there is that woman who said that she was sent over here. So, therefore, when he does go to America, which I do believe he should go to America, then he'll be able to shed some light on why, you know, whether the woman, or rather the two women who came over, whether they came of their own free will, whether they were exploited, as Virginia Jeffrey was.
Hmm.
And it can't, you know, I mean, and the thing that I'm kind of quite cross about, really, is that this has echoes of the attitude that people had at the time towards all those poor girls from the care home, you know.
Right, they deserved it. They had it coming. They were dressing provocatively.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they were up north, you know, and it's kind of like, well, you know, and that woman who said she would have jumped out of a balcony and run away, that, you know, like you just said, it's victim blaming.
Yes.
And now, you know, people are all up in arms about the fact of, you know, the politicians are jumping on that, you know, they should be, you know, they should be investigating it and there needs to be this public inquiry. This is exactly the same thing. This is still victim blaming. Okay, yeah. The victims are a bit older and the people involved are richer and more powerful, but it's still the same thing.
Yes, I do recall one judge's famous comment on a case similar to the one we're talking about was that the victim was guilty of contributory negligence.
Yeah.
Which I think sums it up in a few pithy syllables, precisely this sort of warped idea of what's right and wrong that we're talking about. Good to talk to you, Sharon. Thanks for that. 0345 6060973. It looks like that we have the former senior advisor at the US State Department and the White House National Security under President Biden. Naga Anger is on the phone. Hello, Naga.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate your time. The U.S. president has warned that he could take military action against Iran over its killing of peaceful protesters, and last night said that very big American warships were headed for the region. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, warned Donald Trump that the entire region will be engulfed in conflict if the U.S. starts a war. Now, Trump, of course, has said to the Iranian people, go out and protest, and I will have your back, essentially. Keep protesting, help is on the way. And they did keep protesting, and the help did not appear, and tens of thousands died. Why should anybody in Iran trust what Trump says?
Look, I think, you know, the risk of war is real, but not inevitable. And I think, you know, there's some feelings of heightened tension tonight, because there's so much posturing, and escalating signals that they're putting out. I think one of the things that we're seeing, and I think the Iranian public is paying attention to, is that there's quite a bit of hedging that's happening between, the U.S. and Iran. So one thing is certain that the Iranians, at least have not pushed out any information, and the human rights organizations haven't been able to gather whether any, killings happened in prison, which there was a threat of. I think the key here that's so concerning is that this is partly heart-wrenching, because you're starting to see more footage and testimony emerging. You're seeing the scale of the massacre and the injuries from the crackdown, people being shot, beaten, disappeared. And these are real lives. And I think as the U.S. government is providing options to the president of the United States, all of these are being factored, because beyond it being a moral tragedy, it's shaping the strategic environment in the region. Iran is becoming more and more isolated. The stakes are becoming even higher as different countries are making these external decisions because of people's lives. And, you know, again, going back to the hedging that's happening right now, we've been seeing some reporting coming out of Axios that U.S. officials have confirmed that there will be a potential U.S.-Iran meeting that could take place as early as this week in Turkey, right, with Ankara and Qatar trying to help facilitate a conversation, kind of a de-escalation of any potential kinetic action. But that also shows that the U.S. is interested in genuine negotiations and is not looking at conducting, at least for now, kinetic actions.
Yes, but the man said very big ships are on the way. I mean, I'm sure that that's an enormous expense and they are bristling with armaments. It seems hard to believe that a person like Trump wouldn't use them in some way.
I think he's keeping all options on the table. I think that's how you're supposed to be, you know, observing the situation, because I don't think he's necessarily desperate to avoid war, and he's not desperate to enter war, because you have to bear in mind the also on the U.S. domestic politics side. I mean, Trump himself clearly wants to avoid another Middle East war, another forever war, given a lot of the domestic skepticism and obviously fatigue with forever wars in the region. But he also believes that Iran only moves under extreme pressure. With this dual track, he's basically saying, I'm open to talks. But at the same time, I'm going to show you visible military escalation by deploying these naval forces, by reinforcing missile defenses. But he's basically trying to preserve leverage without committing the United States to war.
Yes, and the conversation is going to be about nuclear proliferation, nuclear proliferation deal with Iran. But didn't we have one of those that appeared to be working until Trump tore it up? Probably because it was Barack Obama that signed it.
You know, he's claiming that he will have, a tighter negotiation. He's going to, you know, essentially bring the Iranian government to their knees. But the problem is Iran right now is not desperate enough to concede, right? And the U.S. isn't willing to settle for half measures, because those half measures would be what the 2015 JCPOA looked like. So I think this is a lot of wait and see. I think there'll be quite a bit of conversations, diplomatic conversations for something. But we may be, you know, having the same conversation again in about 2 weeks, where, you know, are kinetic strikes going to happen, or maybe in a week, you know, will this get escalated because they couldn't have, meet in a middle ground for nuclear negotiations.
Yeah, you said that they're leaving everything on the table. Is that just a pseudonym for they don't really have any idea what to do next, and they certainly don't have a clue what to do if the regime falls?
I think, the priorities are very different. You know, I think for the U.S., the focus is making sure that Iran does not have any, essentially gives up its uranium enrichment in some form, and limits its missile production because of the regional proxy network that Iran has, right? And so I think the focus is really there. Of course, there is an inherent, concern about what happens next and who would fill the vacuum if the regime were to fall. But the priority for the U.S., as I'm reading it right now, for this administration, is really trying to just dismantle their nuclear capabilities.
Right, which, I mean, again, they only have because Trump tore up a deal to restrict their nuclear proliferation, which was apparently working at the time. Why would he do that and then insist on trying to negotiate the same thing?
I think it's hard to predict and understand some of the decisions that are made. But I think at the time it was, you know, this was a weak deal. We were not getting a good enough bargain. And right now, his proposal is something much stronger. And obviously right now we've seen the Europeans have also agreed to put the IRGC on the terrorist watch list. It's going after the funds and the assets and just even the capability of IRGC members and their families traveling to the West. So it's really clamping down on them. And part of it is hopefully, looking to flip the security apparatus to defecting. But at the same time, it's also putting really putting pressure on them. It is, you know, this sort of economic strangulation that we also saw kind of in the Venezuela playbook as well.
Yes, that economic strangulation doesn't really do the citizens any good, does it? I mean, a regime can withstand it, but the citizenry suffer.
And the argument is these sanctions are far more targeted towards the security apparatus. And it's trying to, again, all the sanctions that have been imposed till now have impacted the average Iranian citizen to the point where inflation was so high, it was impossible for people to buy bread, let alone meat. But what's happening now, since end of December, is really targeting the IRGC, targeting the besieged, targeting all of these the Iran's security apparatus to really bring them to their knees and either getting them to defect or getting them to just agree to a deal on the nuclear file.
If Iran didn't have the third largest oil reserves in the world, do you think we would even be talking about this?
We would still be talking about it if they had the same kind of influence with proxies in the region. I think one of the things that you're seeing with why the regional players like Turkey, like the Saudis, like the Emiratis, the Omanis, the Qataris are actively working the phone lines, you know, hitting the pavement, going to Western capitals, really trying to de-escalate this is because of Iran's proxy network. It may not be as strong as it was in the past, but it still exists. And everyone wants to try to avoid war because it can, you know, occur on all fronts. So if they, regardless of oil, if they still had a proxy network, this would be a major issue.
Very good to talk to you, Negar. Thanks so much for your time. Negar Anger, former senior advisor at the US State Department and the White House National Security under President Biden. Now we're going to take a short break and then come back to your thoughts about the Epstein case and Andrew's involvement with Jeffrey Epstein and whether you think that he should go and tell what he knows to this American committee that is looking into it, or whether you think it's time that we just forget about it and move on. 0345 6060 973.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
We've had migration mathematics from Shabana Mahmood, but do her numbers add up?
The numbers as of today, we've had 350 people come into the country from France and 281 have been removed.
And a channel crisis made in China.
60% of crossings last year had engines that were Chinese made at their heart.
And a prime minister hoping for a pole swing after his work in Beijing.
China is a vital player on the global stage, and it's vital that we build a more sophisticated relationship.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast, back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Go on, leave the never-ending laundry pile, quiet flat, and empty fridge at home. Hop on the train and go into the workplace zone with Southeastern. Whether you're heading in for a change of scene, to share ideas, or enjoy a lunchtime chat with your colleagues. With our great range of tickets, we've got the one to suit your commute. Buy yours now on our app or website and pay no booking fees. So, go on, go in.
Southeastern. Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the future you want. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Imad, a GCSE student in Year 11.
Alongside my core GCSEs, such as Maths, English and Science, I study creative subjects such as Media, Drama, Art and Design, Business and Music Technology, which are all recognised by the industry.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in Years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
At Lidl, there's always more to value. Like switching from Sainsbury's to Lidl and saving £33 on this week's big shop at lidl.co.uk/save. Which means a stocked up fridge of big brands, award-winning own brands, and your fresh five a day with extra helpings encouraged. Lidl, more to value.
Process check 26th of the first 26. Sainsbury's also sell other products. See online for more details.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
Attention dogs, this is not a drill. If your dinner comes in dodgy brown balls or smells suspicious, at best, you deserve to know this. Butternut Box makes fresh dog food with ingredients you'd find in your human's fridge. In fact, some humans have even tasted it. For quality control, obviously. Anyway, let's hope your human was listening. Butternut Box. Fresh food, happy dogs. Try Butternut Box today and get 25% off your first two boxes. Offer available online in the UK and Ireland to first-time customers only.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So we were talking about Jeffrey Epstein and how his life has coincided with Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's, the former Prince Andrew. And Keir Starmer has said that Andrew should be interested in going to give his testimony about his relationship to Jeffrey Epstein to a US congressional committee. So far, Andrew has shown no desire to do that. Stratford upon Avon. Hello, Jane.
Hello, Nick. It's quite some time since I've spoken to you.
Oh, yes.
My ire is raised by tonight's conversation. The first woman that you spoke to, the American lawyer, saying that there are more important things in the world. They don't need to be done one or the other. There's enough room in the world to deal with all of these things.
Yes.
When it comes to abuse of young women, and often underage young women, it's so seedy and vile. Andrew will never go to America. There's absolutely no way on God's green earth that he's ever going to go. He's a part of the royal family. I'm not a royalist, I'm afraid. So I'm not. My sympathy is not with any of them. But there's absolutely no chance that he will go. Keir Starmer saying that he should. Keir Starmer, he will know the law far better than I do, but there's no chance that Andrew will go. But the main thing that I didn't like from earlier callers was this victim blaming. It reminded me a lot of domestic violence when people say, well, why doesn't she just leave? Doesn't she just leave?
Yeah.
These things are not always an opportunity. These girls that we have seen on the ones that I've seen on the television talking about being involved in this Epstein scandal, I don't know what their backgrounds are. When I was 17, if I disappeared from sight, my parents would have been after me, you know, until they dropped dead. Mm. And the same with us, with our children. We would be looking. But we don't know the backgrounds these kids come from. It's not all the same. We're not all born dead lucky.
Right, yes. I mean, as far as I'm aware, the type of girls that Epstein and his enablers targeted were those that perhaps would not be missed or who were troubled in some way, you know, sort of easy pickings, if you like.
No, that doesn't surprise me. But that doesn't mean the whole, all of it is absolutely sick-making. Andrew, he's a despicable character anyway. I've never liked him. I did hear today, I don't know where I heard this actually, that his ex-wife actually asked Epstein to ask him to marry her.
That's a new one on me.
honestly, I've heard that today. It wasn't on the wireless, the radio.
Right.
Somebody's told me, I haven't had that many conversations today, but I mean, she's a strange bod as well, isn't she? You know, for nothing, off the back of the taxpayer.
You could say that strange bods could be the subtitle of the royal family. I mean, they live a strange life, and no doubt that has some effect on the personality. Thanks for that, Jane. 0345 6060 973. Peter in Penge says, I guess we should leave it alone now. Andrew has been stripped and humiliated. We have other things to do. I'm really surprised that so many people think that. Craig says, even if Andrew was forced to give evidence, all that would happen is he'd say, I can't remember. Or do American thing of pleading the Fifth Amendment, the right against self-incrimination. But then there would be no point in going if he was going to do that. And that would look even worse than not going, surely. And John says, my take is we should never forget and we should hammer these men as hard as we can if it is proven that there is wrongdoing. Also, let's not forget that Andrew was effectively being paid by the British public, by the taxpayer. Haringey. Hello, Peter. No, sorry, my mistake. Andrew.
Nick.
Yes, sir.
Imagine going to a lawyer and asking them to take on your case. And the lawyer saying, well, what evidence have you got? And you go, well, I've got about 3 million documents, including videos, emails, photos. In fact, 2 Eiffel Towers of evidence and a long list of witnesses you can call. And the lawyer going, well, that's not enough.
Well, yes, but, you know, there's been 1 million or 2 million files released, which is an unimaginable amount of evidence. And so far, apparently, they haven't been able to pin a crime on anybody but Epstein and his, what's her name? The Maxwell.
Ghislaine Maxwell.
Yeah.
Well, imagine if a working class person was accused of what Andrew's accused of, Virginia Giuffre. And his alibi was a complete pack of lies about pretending to go to Pizza Express. And there's photographic evidence of him with. He'd be banged up before you could say Jack Robinson. It's just ridiculous. And as for those callers phoning in to victim shame the girls,
yeah,
I strongly recommend that they read Andrew Lowney's gripping book entitled... it's the honestly, it's the most compelling non-fiction book I've ever read. Although you do have to read it in a freezer to stop your blood from boiling. and what it is, it's 350 pages of hideous, grifting, vile, arrogant, nasty behaviour by both of them, which outside of the Epstein files would have you baying for their blood. It's just despicable the way that they're allowed to get and just walk away from all of this.
Yes, well, you said that that Prince Andrew lied about what he about his various meetings and so on. We don't know whether he lied or whether just recollections differ, and you know. So until proven otherwise, but thanks for that, Andrew. Haringey, Peter.
Hello. Yeah, I think this is ridiculous. What going after Prince Andrew when? There are so many other people that must know involved in this. In America, why aren't they going after all the people in America? President Trump, all the other people that... All about all the support staff, everything, you know, it's ridiculous.
Well, that's an interesting idea, the support staff. I mean, there must have been people who knew what was going on because, you know, a billionaire's residence does not... upkeep itself. It must have no end.
Yeah, it must
staff.
Be... Well, you know, it must be... Where is the smoking gun on all these other people? I mean, on Prince Andrew, it's just been going on years and years. Documents keep coming, and there's nothing really showing other than just some salacious pictures that people can make up wherever they want.
Yes.
I don't think it really proves anything.
Well, a conspiracy theorist might think that that's exactly the plan, that to sort of flood us with an enormous amount of files signifying nothing.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's it. I mean, I think there are more important people and people to go after rather than Prince Andrew. I think I don't think even if Prince Andrew revealed whatever extra he might know, is not going to be enough to convict anything or anyone, really.
Well, we don't know until we hear from the man himself, but it's entirely possible, yes. All right, thanks, Peter. Birmingham, Michelle.
Hi, I know you've not got much long left. I've just come off the motorway and I've had to pull over because the first caller that you had, Heather, that rang in about this subject. So my first point is this. I think that the papers, every day they can print a story, print it, make all of the men that are complicit in this, and there's females as well, make them squirm, make them sit on the edge and think, have they got something completely concrete? Let them feel how those victims must have felt when these people was doing the things that they was doing to them and abusing them. Secondly, Heather that rang in, I'm not too sure if Heather, it's made me so angry listening. Heather, like, I don't know if she used to work for a local authority somewhere up north or a police force, but to hear the way that she spoke, as a female as well, there was not one ounce of compassion from her. It kind of transported you back to a time when a woman could be raped and was then told,
well, it's your fault because your skirt was too short.
Right.
Or it made me think of the police officer that's just received another life sentence for sexual assault that used his power and the victims had to stay quiet. I'd like to say this to anybody that's listening that's suffering any kind of abuse. The majority of us don't hold those attitudes. And there is victims, regardless of their ages, and there's a process that these perpetrators take and they manipulate. They would have... You imagine people with that much money and wealth, they can cover anything up, but they would have... the victims, they would have, you know, come on, an impressionable girl, let's go on my 50-foot yacht, let's do this. But at some point, those victims have to pay back, and they paid with their bodies, and they paid with their, in the case of Virginia Giuffre, they paid with their mental health, their minds, their life. And there's not just female victims out there, there's male victims as well. I just want to say... And Tobin that rang up, that was the third call that I heard. And I thought, thank God, after listening to Heather, and then the next guy that was like, we don't want to hear it no more. Right. No, we do.
Okay. All right, Michelle, I'm going to have to leave it there because I've just run out of time. But thanks for that. I just want to read one message. Tiago says, millions of pages from the Epstein files, still no trans people or drag queens. The groups constantly painted as a risk to children. Instead, the names that keep appearing are powerful white men. Many who also bankroll and amplify that hate message. Funny how that works. Yeah, that is curious, ain't it? Now, I'm going to switch it up after the news. Green Party leader Zach Polanski says there needs to be a system change on drugs policy so that people can get help from medical professionals. He says the sheer number of deaths from drug harm is proof that the current approach is not working. He proposes a public health approach to legalise and regulate drugs. Keir Starmer criticised this position and called the Green Party reckless and irresponsible. So who's right? The Prime Minister or the leader of the Green Party? Should we legalise drugs in the UK? And if not, what else needs to change? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, Peter Mandelson has resigned from the Labour Party after more revelations about his relationship with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. He says he wants to avoid causing it any further embarrassment. LBC's Thomas Watts has more.
Lord Mandelson was sacked as the British ambassador to Washington last year because of his links to Epstein. Now he's told Labour's general secretary that he's stepping down from his party membership. He's used his resignation letter to say, "I have been further linked this weekend to the understandable furore surrounding Jeffrey Epstein, and I feel regretful and sorry about this. Allegations, which I believe to be false, that he made financial payments to me 20 years ago, and of which I have no record or recollection, need investigating by me." Mandelson was a key architect of the New Labour project during the 1990s. It was the rebrand which helped bring Sir Tony Blair to power in 1997.
The Shadow Home Secretary has told LBC Andrew Mountbatten Windsor should be removed from the royal line of succession. Chris Philp's been speaking after new calls from the Prime Minister for the King's brother to testify to the US Congress about his links to Jeffrey Epstein. President Trump has responded to warnings about regional stability from Iran's supreme leader by saying he hopes to reach an agreement with Tehran. The two nations are at odds over the Gulf state's nuclear program. A major buildup of Washington's forces has developed in the region. But the former senior advisor to the US State Department, Nega Anger, has been telling Nick Abbott on LBC, conflict is not a given.
We've been seeing some reporting that U.S. officials have confirmed that there will be a potential U.S.-Iran meeting that could take place as early as this week in Turkey, with Ankara and Qatar trying to help facilitate. That also shows that the U.S. is interested in genuine negotiations and is not looking at conducting, at least for now, kinetic actions.
And the government says free breakfast clubs are to be rolled out to hundreds more primary schools in England. The Department for Education says another 300,000 children will benefit from the programme in April. More than 500 new schools are expected to join the scheme. LBC weather, cloudy with rain clearing to the southeast overnight. It'll be clear in the southwest, Wales and Northern Ireland, and there could be some patchy ice around there. We'll see a low of around 3 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
The leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski, says that there needs to be a system change on drugs policy. He called for what he calls a public health approach that would ensure that somebody who had a problematic relationship with drugs could get help from a medical professional. So let's talk about this with Frank Stedman. Frank is a former prisoner, anti-crime advocate and author of To Be Frank, which is a book about his time being involved in high-level drug crime. Hello, Frank.
Good evening, Nick.
So they've been prosecuting the war on drugs since 1971, 55 years later. Is it fair to say the drugs won?
Well, it's, at the moment, it's sort of ahead, isn't it, as such? I think if, in my experience, you know, you get put in prison, somebody just steps into your shoes as such, don't they?
Yes, that is the it of it, isn't it? People aren't going to stop taking drugs, regardless of how illegal governments make them. That if we've learned anything from the last 55 years, it's that.
And pushing things to the black market just causes, you know, the price to go up. And, you know, these young kids want to earn loads of money and they think that's the way to earn loads of money, and it really isn't. The problem with policies, I think, what Zach was saying about, I know in Scotland, they've just opened something in Scotland where they can legally take drugs.
Yes.
On the taking drugs and if someone's got a drug problem, but it's not taught in schools a lot either. I've done talks in schools and they have somebody in a couple of times a year to go in for drug prevention. And, if you change your policy, it's got a, you know, drug policy in a country, it's got a global, you know, you've got to think globally, because there's places in Mexico and Colombia that are getting ruined by, well, the drug that I was involved in anyway.
Yeah, but do you think they're being ruined by that drug because of its very illegality?
Well, I wouldn't say make it legal because it's caused so much misery, but something needs to change. But I think what Zach was saying, I'm not, you know, sticking up for anybody or picking sides, but I think he's right in, at the, you know, at the ground where people have got a problem with taking drugs, that could be controlled and maybe in a safer place. But, you know, organised crime, you can't allow that to go on, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the way it is at the moment, if you are going to take an illegal drug, you have absolutely no choice other than to go to a criminal, by definition. And so all of the money that could be, you know, virtuously circling around the economy is going straight in the pockets of what the state and many of us would think of as undesirables.
Yeah, well, do you know what? We've got a bit of a problem with the funding because we've put something like £4 to £7 billion into building new prisons, and I think £200 million's gone to probation. So there's such a massive, it might, you know, if you look at that black and white, that all their interest in building prisons and filling cells up instead of actually trying to help the community by organising it. But things do need to change. The prison system's broken and people are in and out of prison. And a problem you find with drugs is, like you say, it's getting more and more popular. And these young kids are taking different drugs and there's different drugs coming on. And what's happening now, it's just been that you're going to walk in somewhere and everybody's going to be taking drugs. I know my children, my son's 20, and if he goes out in a pub, he said to me that everybody's can get some or know something, somebody.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, there haven't really been any successes in this war on drugs at all, other than filling our prisons with people who otherwise wouldn't be in there. I mean, in America, not so here, really, but in America, it's used as a sort of money-making machine. You know, prisons are privately run, and so the state seems to have an obligation, really, to fill them with people. And how are you going to do that? Well, just to arrest people in places of poverty and deprivation.
Yeah. And we've got a lot of private prisons, and I was in one where we'd done jobs that the prison got paid for, and then we got paid to do the jobs. So it is, I think they might be secretly testing that out here in a weird way, where maybe these prisons, because I think, isn't it electrical goods in America? Is that what you're alluding at? The electrical goods in America, 80% of them or something, are made by prisoners.
I didn't know that. I know they make...
Don't quote me on the...
Well, they could. They could do. Yeah, I know. They make license plates and mail bags and and that sort of thing. But yeah, it is a money making scheme, putting people in prison.
And I think the private jails in this country doesn't give them money for the prisoners as well.
I really don't know anything about that.
I'm pretty sure the government will give the private jail funding for each prisoner they take. So like you say, I think it's becoming a business. And then even down to construction, I'm in construction. You've got these specialist companies that build prisons and they're pretty much just going in and naming their price. And this is why the prisons are coming to, I think it's like £8 billion we're spending on free prisons. And like I said earlier, we're not spending no money in actually trying to stop crime.
What do you think of when Zach Polanski said that there's a racial ban on policing drugs? He said it's become very racialised. Very often it's young black people who are stopped and searched in the street, despite the fact there's no evidence they're more likely to be holding or taking drugs. And there really is a disparity between white people and black people who are in prison. Much more...
Yeah.
Many more black and minority ethnic offenders are likely to be in prison for drug offences than white people.
Yeah, he has gone purely from, if you look at the statistics, he's right. In the statistics, black people are more likely to get arrested and put into prison than white people. And that's the statistic in this country. I don't know who's took the statistic, but I think the organised crime that I was involved in, I don't think they cared who it was. I think they just wanted to get whoever, and it was an undercover drug bust, and they wouldn't have cared whether you was black or white, whoever you was. But I think what is that is down to the street level and people street dealing, and I think what's happening is, this is only from my experience, the police are going into inner city areas, and they're probably thinking, oh, I'll go into this black area, because I've got more chance of arresting someone than a white area, but that isn't the case. And it does say on the statistics that black people are getting arrested and put into prison more than white people. And it's nothing to do with them committing the crime. I think it's more of the police's thinking that way, so they're going into them.
It's also probably indicative of the fact that areas that you would call black areas are more deprived than the neighbouring areas, which you would similarly call white areas. And in areas of deprivation, that's where drug use goes up, isn't it? It's almost as though we're trying to cure the patient, not by dealing with the source, but dealing with the symptom.
Well, I don't know whether... You know, black areas are poorer than any other areas. I'm not too sure, but it's like what you're saying. I think they're more worried about arresting people than they are thinking, do you know what? This area's got a problem with drugs. Let's get some workers in there, as in like charity workers, and see what the problem is before they send a gang of police in kicking people's doors down. I know there is people doing that, as in charity workers, but it just isn't enough. You know, I do talks in schools, and some of the schools haven't got any time to fund, as in like to have people come in and do talks. And everyone, all my friends who are ex-criminals and they're doing talks in schools, they've got jobs. So if they have a day off of work, they have to charge. And these schools, like, we can't. So it is, you know, a lot of these schools, we could start at the beginning and, you know, instead of fixing broken adults, we could educate children.
Do you think some of the problem with this, the way that it is talked about, is that it's always people who have, it's drug addicts, people who are problematic drug takers. But you don't talk about that in the same way as alcohol. You know, people who drink alcohol aren't addicts. But most of the people aren't.
Dependent, yeah.
But it's almost like... Only two definitions. You either don't take drugs at all, or you abuse drugs. There doesn't seem to be an acknowledgement that drugs can be taken by people who have perfectly normal lives. They might have, you know, high-paying jobs, and they do their work perfectly well, and then relax at the weekend with, you know, some people would have a martini or a bottle of wine or something, and some other people would have a joint. But the conversation is not like that. It's like, if you're the person that has a joint, then you're a drug addict. And children... people of all ages, they will hear that and recognise that it doesn't chime with their experience, and then ignore all other messages.
Yeah, I think when someone says drug addict, they automatically think of somebody running around the streets, homeless, breaking into, you know, shops or to just get some money just for their drugs. But there's drug addicts that are just functioning and they go to work every single week and just carry on with their life, which isn't good at all. But it's, you know, a lot of these, you know, young men are dependent on drugs, going on a night out for insecure reasons, or they feel like they're not going to have a good time. So it's a very hard, without looking at the whole scale, but you've got to crack a few eggs, and I think the policy needs to change. But how you change it, I really don't know, unless you speak to every single person. But like we said earlier, someone stops taking drugs and somebody else just steps into that, taking drugs.
Yes, but...
You said it yourself just now,
that, you know, somebody will go out of a night and feel that they can't have fun unless they're on drugs. But that's not what most people think when they go out and, you know, I don't know what the kids these days are taking, but like 20 years ago, it was ecstasy. People didn't think, yeah, oh, I can't have a good time if I don't take ecstasy. It would just be part of the evening. It would be... something that they took and enhanced, you know, like like alcohol enhances certain social situations. But nobody ever talks about it like that. It's always these people who take drugs, they have a problem. They are antisocial. They must be dealt with in some way. I mean, at the very best, they must have therapy, and they must go on sort of drug reduction taking courses and so on. And I think that partly people who take drugs casually, you know, which is a large number of people in this country, they will hear that message and they think, well, that doesn't relate to me. I'm not a drug addict. And so they will then ignore all other, quite possibly positive things that people such as yourself or the government are putting out. I think it's the initial attitude to people who take drugs that is sort of making the takers resistant to a message that might actually help them.
Yeah, it's drugs is just demonised across the whole board, isn't it?
Yes.
And I think it's purely, I think it's what we've pumped through the news, isn't it? And, you know, films and... But at the end of the day, I know I was involved in drugs for a few years, but it's... I couldn't sit here and say, you know... If one guy's going out and taking drugs and he can handle it and it's not a problem for him, that's fine. Because the problem is where he's getting them drugs, that actual avenue then drugs come through.
Right.
Is, you know, there's in mass graves in Mexico, there's villages getting ruined in Colombia.
Yeah.
Being input, which we all know.
But all just, that is because it's illegal, isn't it? Those are gangs fighting with each other for turf and money. If it was legal and people could just go down to the chemist and buy whatever it is they're after, then probably none of that would happen. Or it might happen for, you know, for prostitution or, you know, whatever other thing that the organised crime would get into.
Do you know what? It's never been done, has it? So how would we know? Has it been done... I know a lot of the Baltic countries, their prison systems are really good, but has that ever been done, you know, to maybe...
To legalise all drugs, yes.
I wouldn't legalise all drugs, but I definitely would probably help the people with the problems. Do you know if somebody's going out, you can't literally go in somebody's house and say, do you take drugs? But people have got a problem with it. Maybe help them and give them a safe place, like they do in Scotland.
Right, maybe that's part of the problem, that people would not readily admit taking drugs to a person with a clipboard saying that they are representing the government. It's that the authorities only see the people when they have got to the point of having a problem.
Yes, yeah, so maybe that is, yeah.
Portugal, I'm not sure whether they legalised it or decriminalised it. Either way, Portugal has been, I think, the longest-running experiment in the world, 2001, I think, something like that. And their experience is that removing the criminal penalties for personal possession of any drug did not cause drug taking to skyrocket. And that's the other thing that people assume, that if you decriminalise something or legalise it, then many more people are going to take it. But the evidence doesn't support that.
I probably agree with that.
Yeah.
You would, because like you say, and like I said earlier, it's so readily available, so whether it's legal or not, but I just think the organised crime and the involved in drugs, you can't, I think that Nick, the Green Party bloke, said, you know, somebody in the government's laughing, saying they're taking drugs, but they're putting people in prison for
right.
it.
Yes.
Which is true, but I just can't, if you go up, you know, who's going to deal with the drugs? And is the government going to have to go and speak to this guy they've put in prison for 20 years and say, oh, by the way, we're going to legalise drugs. Can you help us get it into the country? And he's going to say no, unless you get me out of prison. So there's going to be such a... that's how else would you do it? Imagine somebody from the government going to a drug gang in another country and saying,
well,
our English government want to buy drugs so we can legalise it. They would be like, no way.
I'm not sure that they would do that. I mean, there's legal ways for the authorities to get hold of pretty much any kind of drug you would imagine. I mean, marijuana, I think we're the biggest grower of medical marijuana in the world in this country, weirdly. The dentistry profession gets hold of cocaine, you know, all this stuff is available. It just would be better if we weren't buying it from the kind of people that you used to hang out with, forgive me.
It's you're being completely honest.
Good to talk to you, Frank. Thanks so much for that. That's Frank Stedman, former prisoner, anti-crime advocate and author of To Be Frank. That's a book about his time being involved in high-level drug crime. So what do you think about this? The Green Party leader, Zach Polanski, said he backs the legalisation of drugs. He called for a public health approach that would ensure that someone who had a problematic relationship with drugs could get help from a medical professional. But he also implied that people should be able to, go out and do whatever. What business is it of the government? And there are some countries that have experimented either completely to decriminalise drugs or to decriminalise a few of them, and with pretty much the same result all over. So we'll talk about that when we come back. 0345 6060 973.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
They have fatal incompetence.
Straight to the point.
What is the problem they've got over there?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
The country's going backwards. Growth down. Energy prices up.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
Hiya, Kenny the Hamster here. Proud pet of Doug and Carol. Hey, up. Looks like my mum Carol's off out with the girls again. I tell you, since she took that quick NHS Healthy Choices quiz, she's drinking less, but going out more. And to think, she thought being healthy would mean being boring. You might want to give it a go yourself.
Go, girlfriend!
Take your first little step to healthy. Search NHS Healthy Choices quiz to get a score and a simple plan to follow.
Go on, leave the never-ending laundry pile. Quiet flat. And empty fridge at home. Hop on the train and go into the workplace zone with Southeastern. Whether you're heading in for a change of scene, to share ideas, or enjoy a lunchtime chat with your colleagues, with our great range of tickets, we've got the one to suit your commute. Buy yours now on our app or website and pay no booking fees. So, go on, go in.
Southeastern.
Sunlight's guaranteed over 50 plan gave confidence to Jane and Chris. With their insurance sorted, they're becoming naturists. Cutting loose in their birthday suits, feeling elegant and free. But when they answered the door, the postman saw more than he expected to see. Sunlight, a little confidence goes a long way. No medical questions and a cash payout. Search Sunlight cover today.
Premiums paid could exceed the payout. Full cover after 1 year. Ages 49 to 85.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So the leader of the Green Party, whose support is concentrated among the young, is saying that we need a system change on drugs policy. And it seems that the government, of not just this government, but all governments that I can recall, their response to demands to look at the drugs laws has always been to commission a report. which has usually, if not always, said that what we're doing now isn't working for anyone and we should change our approach. At which the government of the day ignores its recommendations and commissions another report, expecting a different response. Are we ever going to get out of this cycle of inaction? 0345 6060 973. Tavistock, hello, Rose. A Rose? Too late. Bristol, Tiago.
Oh, hi, Nick. Thanks for having me on.
Tiago.
Drugs, right? I don't disagree with Zach, but I also don't fully agree. In the sense that I know that in an ideal world, we could have a framework where legalization and even the controlled, you know, creation of drugs in order to deal with harm reduction exists, but that will never wash in a place like the UK.
Why?
And just because people are too close-minded to accept that even though people have made bad choices, they shouldn't be punished by that, because people see drug use as a moral failure. And they're still too deeply imbued in the way that British society functions, in my opinion.
Well, I get what you're saying, but we're not that different from Luxembourg. And if you've ever been to Luxembourg, you know it's one of the most small-c conservative places in the world. Portugal, fairly conservative and religious. Yeah, and Italy, Germany, all of these places.
And that's exactly where my next point comes. I mean, Portugal, I think, strikes the right balance, you know, the decriminalization. And I think is the first step. And I get it. I think what I wish Zach had done, I don't disagree with him pushing for the best possible scenario, but they're becoming a much more credible choice. They're gaining ground. The local elections are coming around the corner, should be a great win for them. And this, unfortunately, just give easy bait for the right-wing media to deride him and try to make him sound ridiculous.
Yes, maybe, but the Green Party, the people who are going to vote for the Green Party probably don't read the right-wing media. They read social media, which these days, oddly, is being run by people who have the same political opinion as the right-wing offshore-owned billionaire press barons.
Well, perhaps you're right, but there might be the odd person who would have perhaps voted Liberal Democrat, who is, you know, kind of like progressive overall, but still holds some conservative views. And hearing the word, you know, legalize all drugs, spun in a certain way, could sway them. But I don't want to talk about the Greens' electoral strategy. I would much rather talk about drug policy. And yes, I do think it's about time we decriminalize drugs and start treating drug users as criminals. I don't know if you recall, I have mentioned I have spent some time in prison myself, not drug related at all, it was the immigration thing, but most of the young lads that were there were on a very easy kind of revolving door machinery of petty trafficking and low grade crime.
Right.
Because for so many people on their demographic, that is actually a very viable career choice.
Yes.
And we keep ignoring the fact that this, like the previous caller said, you know, you take one of the streets, the void gets filled immediately. And this war on drugs for a start, I think there was an admission from one of the Nixon, I have his name here, someone who worked in the Nixon cabinet, who later admitted outright saying that the policies, his name was John Enrichman, I think, and he said in 1994 in an interview that the policies around cannabis were deliberately created because they couldn't criminalize people for being blacks or for being lefties.
Right. Yeah.
And the times of protest against war. So by criminalizing a drug that they, a substance that they used, allow them to pick away the leaders of certain movements and put them in jail.
Well, that's interesting. I'm going to have to leave it there, Tiago, but thanks for that. It's interesting also that the most likely people to die from using drugs are working-class people over 40 who live in de-industrialized areas. Now, these are areas of deprivation. I mean, part of the problem is poverty, isn't it? And a lack of hope. I mean, would the government since 1990 have been better advised to tackle wealth inequality and the lack of hope that propels people to blot out the world with drugs in the first place? Just a thought. Ah, it looks like Rose is available now. Tavistock.
Hello.
Hello, Rose.
Yes, Nick, I'm in two minds about this. I've been sober off alcohol over 30 years. I keep the date private because it's very important to me. Cannabis made me paranoid and once suicidal. What you get, and it's very difficult to explain this to anyone whose system doesn't react to mind-altering drugs in this way. You get horrors in the head like nothing normal. It's like being in another dimension. Similar with alcohol, but slightly different, and what was worse with the cannabis. And the thing is, the cannabis was passive smoking. I was near people smoking it. And if the smoke becomes unavoidable with legalisation, and I accidentally inhale any, and it doesn't take a lot, I might as well have drunk alcohol. They're the same thing to people with systems like mine. And then not only can I not predict what will happen next, that's the point, because it's like you're a different person. I've lost my sobriety. And it's the same for my young friend who's almost 3 years. And they had 2 years of trying to get free of it. It was cocaine and alcohol.
Right.
And he said they cannot afford to inhale cannabis. Because he'll be a different person.
Yes, I understand what you're saying, but you could also say the same for peanuts. You know, there's some people that peanuts...
Oh, for heaven's sake!
Okay, that's true. There are some people that, if they inhale the smell of peanuts, or they accidentally eat it, or there's food is provided for them that has a peanut residue in it, it will kill them. They won't just feel funny in the head, they'll die. But that doesn't mean to say that all peanuts should be banned from society. For heaven's sake. Thanks, Rose. 0345-6060-973. More of your thoughts on this to come. Going to take a break for the news. And then we'll be looking into who is topping the annual Sunday Times tax list. But first, an update with Tim Daly.
Peter Mandelson has resigned from the Labour Party to avoid causing it further embarrassment over his past friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. Documents released by the US Justice Department include claims the late paedophile paid $75,000 into accounts linked to the former business secretary. The supreme leader of Iran has warned any US strike over its nuclear program would risk causing a regional war. President Trump has responded by saying he's hopeful of making a deal with Tehran. And the government says free breakfast clubs are to be rolled out to hundreds more primary schools in England. The Department for Education says a further 300,000 children will benefit from the programme in April. LBC weather, cloudy with rain clearing to the southeast overnight, but there'll be clear spells for Wales, the southwest and Northern Ireland, which could lead to patchy ice. We'll see a low of around 3 degrees.
This is LBC.
With over 50 years' experience, at Fidelity, we believe there's a difference between investing and being invested. Investing is having access to guidance, tools and expert insights. Being invested means feeling confident about your future. Investing is choosing from a wealth of investment options. Being invested means focusing on your long-term goals. For ISAs, pensions or advice, be truly invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Terms apply.
Sunlight's guaranteed over 50 plan. Gave confidence to Jane and Chris. With their insurance sorted, they're becoming naturists. Cutting loose in their birthday suits, feeling elegant and free. But when they answered the door, the postman saw more than he expected to see. Sunlight, a little confidence goes a long way. Affordable cover with a cash payout. Search Sunlight Cover today.
Premiums paid could exceed the payout. Full cover after 1 year. Ages 49 to 85.
To be or not to be.
Right now we're offering a range of incentives across Audi models.
That is the...
But only until the 28th of February.
The,
So stop whatever you're doing.
I'll be right back. Just carry on without me.
And find yours online or at your local Audi centre. Audi. Vorsprung durch Technik. Terms and conditions apply. Selected models, retail customers and participating Audi centres only.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
The annual Sunday Times tax list has revealed the UK's 100 biggest taxpayers, with gambling magnates Fred and Peter Dunn of Betfred topping the rankings for the first time. the billionaires who established their Warrington-based business in 1967, contributed about £400 million in tax over the past year, a near 50% increase on their previous year's bill. And collectively, we are told, the top 100 taxpayers paid £5.7 billion in tax. That's a big rise from the £4.9 billion which was recorded the previous year. Let's talk about this with Mike Lewis. Mike is director of Tax Watch, which is an investigative think tank shining a light on who pays tax, who doesn't, and why. Hello, Mike.
Hi, good evening.
Well, given the secrecy surrounding the affairs of the super rich, how can the Sunday Times really know how much they're worth, which is the only true measure of how much, as a percentage of the wealth that they have, they pay in tax?
Well, you've really put your finger on it there. So there are, you know, undoubtedly some real kind of tax heroes on this list who are paying their fair share, who aren't playing offshore games with their tax residents or elaborate offshore shell companies or trusts. But as you say, neither we nor the Sunday Times can actually know what any of these individuals pay in tax, because in this country, as in many countries, individuals' tax affairs are secret. And so what the Sunday Times has done instead is add up all the taxes, corporation tax, employers' national insurance, everything else that's paid by the massive companies that most of these individuals own. And then it attributes all of that tax entirely to the people who own the companies, those companies' shareholders, which is not how you or I would understand personal tax. And as you say, the total amount of tax that the Sunday Times attributes to these people has gone up quite a lot this year. But that's basically because the rate of corporation tax is rising over time.
Yes. It seems to me like a sleight of hand, isn't it? Because the tax that is recorded as having been paid is from income, but that's not where the wealth is. I mean, that's in the appreciation in the value of their assets, which gets taxed at a much lower rate, or in many cases, not at all.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, there's two things to say. One is that if you look at wealthy people's anonymized tax returns, which obviously the Sunday Times doesn't have access to, but researchers do look at them. If you look at those tax returns, what you see is that over about half a million pounds, people's tax bills actually decrease as a percentage of their income and gains as their income goes up. So our personal tax system is actually regressive over about half a million pounds. But obviously that's not the depiction that these very, very large, sort of freakishly large numbers in this tax list make it look like.
Yes, the Sunday Times seems to be in the business of putting a halo of piety around people who have done particularly well. I mean, it seems odd that their number one stars in this list are two men who get their money from other people losing theirs.
Well, look, setting aside how people make their money, and as you say, you know, we can argue about the merits of how much these people get paid. We can argue about, for example, as you say, the pros and cons of the gambling industry or other industries that these people represent. But I wouldn't want to take away from the fact that there are, just in tax terms, some people on this list who clearly do pay their fair share. They get paid through the payroll of their companies, just like us. They pay income tax and employers' national insurance. But they're sort of mixed in this list, indistinguishably, with CEOs and celebrities who've actually taken steps to reduce their UK personal taxes in ways most people can't. So there are people on this list, for example, who are getting paid via, you know, offshore service companies in zero tax jurisdictions. The 2024 tax list even included an individual who's not nine-figure tax bill, which put him on the list, was the result of the UK's largest ever tax fraud conviction. So to name all of these people as tax heroes, I think if I was somebody on this list who was, you know, who was paying their fair share, I'd be a bit annoyed to be mixed in with a lot of other people who perhaps aren't.
Yeah, you said that the taxation is regressive after a certain amount. The law is regressive as well, because the law is written, I would imagine, by the people who would benefit from being able to hide or disappear their enormous wealth from the taxman. It's the kind of thing that is, you know, available to the super rich. They can employ shiny buildings full of genius accountants who can just disappear their money, whereas an ordinary person wouldn't be able to do any of that, and so has to pay the exact amount that the government requires of them.
Well, there's one thing about how the law treats different kinds of income and gains. And as you say, the more well off you are, the more likely you are to get some of your income as forms of investment income or dividends or capital gains in ways that are taxed less than, you know, you and I would be taxed on our pay as you earn income tax bill. But then there's a separate problem about people not paying what is due. So, you know, avoiding and evading tax. And one thing we can see from HMRC's own statistics is that what they call the wealthy tax gap, that's to say that the due taxes that are avoided or evaded by around about the 800,000 most wealthy people, has increased by about 50% since 2021. And it's now nearly the same as all the unpaid taxes of all the 35 million other individual taxpayers combined. So, you know, although, as I said, there are people on this list who earn a kind of eye-watering amount and also probably pay an eye-watering amount of taxes, there is a big problem at the top end of the income distribution about people not paying what is simply due.
And the people at the top, they don't become billionaires through their wages, they become billionaires through the appreciation of their assets. So why should corporation tax and capital gains tax be set at half the rate of income tax? It's about 25% for corporation tax, 24% for capital gains, versus 45% top income tax, or 60%, there's a marginal rate due to the tapering off of personal allowance between 100,000 and 125,000. So those people who earn, you know, £100,000 are paying double the amount that a billionaire is paying for the appreciation of his assets.
Well, the argument about investment income being taxed less than income that you or I would pay on our wages is, I suppose, that tax has been subject to corporation tax already, and then it's paid out, for example, as dividends from a company. And so the idea is that you shouldn't tax that amount as much. Now, it still is just about tax advantageous for people to get paid in dividends rather than in ordinary income and pay ordinary income tax on it. But that wedge between the two has, to be fair, been decreasing over time, and the last budget decreased that wedge more by raising a tax on dividends. But, you know, the much kind of more complex question is the fact that, as you said at the start, wealthy people are often able to construct quite complicated ways to receive their income, in whatever form it comes, in forms of trusts or complex offshore structures. And it's really not clear necessarily that HMRC is getting on top of some of those kinds of very complicated tax arrangements.
A story that we've read a lot lately, we keep being told by those in the business of acting on behalf of the super rich that they are leaving due to taxes. That we can't tax these people because they will go and we will miss them when they're gone. But the top 100 taxpayers, according to the Times, paid £5.7 billion in tax last year, which is up from £4.9 billion. So that's £800,000 million more than the previous year. Doesn't that indicate the story of Exodus's fabrication?
Well, there are two things to say about that. First of all, as you say, Immigration and HMRC's own data shows absolutely no sign of above average emigration of the wealthy. And indeed, 80% of British millionaires that were polled by a group called Patriotic Millionaires support more taxes on the super rich. But the other thing to say, as you say, is that the tax list that's published today actually shows the limits of this anxiety about, the super wealthy leaving the country and that damaging taxes and investment and economic activity in this country. Foreign resident company owners only make it onto this tax list because their companies make huge profits and pay huge amounts of tax here in the UK, which the list then includes in these people's tax contributions. So in other words, even if billionaires want to go live in a tax haven, they're still going to have their businesses in places like the UK because their markets, their consumers, their workers are here and they can't take those with them to Monaco. And these real economic activities will generate employment, growth, and crucially, they'll generate taxes here, which is how these owners of UK companies who live abroad nonetheless get included in the Sunday Times list. So, you can't have it both ways. If you're praising the fact that companies owned by people who no longer live here are still generating a lot of enterprise and tax in the UK, then you can't in the same breath argue that these people's departure is depriving Britain of enterprise and tax revenues. It just doesn't make any sense.
But so let's take the example of somebody who is a trader, a billionaire trader, and they've made an ungodly amount of money, and they decide that because they can't contemplate the notion of losing a single solitary penny of it, that they're going to go and live in some place like Dubai or Monaco. Should those people who leave the country that supported them to become successful, now whether they use the NHS or not, the people that they rely on use the NHS and public schools and the roads and they relied on the police and the fire engine and all of that stuff, should they be able to just up sticks and leave and take all of the money that this country helped them make? Do we not need a punitive exit tax?
Well, there's a question about whether people should be taxed on their way out, and one wouldn't want to be restraining people from moving where they want to move and living where they want to live, however wealthy they are. But I think the point about people like that who are, have a lot of money and are having to invest it, of course, in real businesses, in real places, is that real businesses have to be in real places. So if a trader moves to the United Arab Emirates or Dubai or Monaco or wherever it is, their money is still going to have to be invested in businesses in real places, because as I said, that's where people buy things, that's where people work for companies, that's where markets and consumers are. And so even if somebody's living in Dubai, the real question for the UK is, are we making somewhere like the UK a decent place to build real economic activity and real businesses with real people? And and quite a lot of the things that make that possible, make it possible for business to flourish in this UK, are all the things, of course, the tax pays for. Decent education and educated workforce, good public infrastructure, roads, schools, hospitals. These are all the things that make it possible for businesses to flourish. And that is what will ultimately attract investment.
And yet people still do go. And we're told that, it's because of Keir Starmer or whoever happens to be in number 10 at the time. And they're allowed to do that because countries play off each other. Come here to Ireland and we will charge you less than if you stayed in London. Or come to Luxembourg and we'll charge you practically nothing at all. Isn't it about time that all countries had the same punitive exit taxes to prevent the siphoning off of the wealth that ordinary people have helped make, siphoning it to a computer screen in an empty building in some tax haven in the middle of an ocean? Shouldn't, for the benefit of humankind, isn't it about time that we stop them doing this?
Well, one of the things that that all governments have agreed in the last since 2021 is that at least to have a set of minimum taxes on corporations, and because people own corporations, and corporation tax is effectively a kind of withholding tax, a sort of backstop on individual taxation. What that means is that it's much less possible for people to shift companies, at least, into tax havens and benefit from zero taxes there. One of the most disappointing things we saw in January of this year is that the G7 group of nations, at the behest of the US, at the behest of Donald Trump, decided to exempt US-headed firms, and of course then, the billionaires that own many of those US-headed firms, exempt them from these globally agreed minimum taxes. And the UK went along with that, along with everybody else. And so I think there have been in recent years ways to stop that kind of mobility of taxable income into tax havens, but it's gradually being watered down. And unfortunately, the UK is part of that.
And it's been watered down to an extraordinary amount, which seems to be getting worse by the minute. The wealth of the five richest people on Earth doubled since COVID. It went up for five people. It went up from $340 billion to $869 billion. $869,000 million, five people. I mean, that's America. And it's also true here. I mean, it's a transference from the rest of us to those at the very top, which seems to be accelerating. That's unsustainable, isn't it?
Well, I think there clearly is a problem with, you know, and that's something that you can see in the tax list that's been published today. You know, the reason why these people are being praised for paying eye-watering sums of tax is because they are making eye-watering sums of money. And as I said, we can debate the pros and cons of the salaries and the incomes that these individuals get. But, you know, the really important thing is whether people at this income level are not how much they're paying, but whether they are paying the same kinds of percentages of their income and their gains in tax as the rest of us. And unfortunately, we see that our own country's personal tax system is allowing people to pay less the more they earn over, you know, several hundred thousand pounds. There absolutely is a question about how we really capture the money that, you know, this real sort of extreme top tier of people are making.
Good to talk to you, Mike. Thanks very much for that. That's Mike Lewis, director of Tax Watch, which is an It's a think tank that investigates taxes, shines a light on who pays, who doesn't, and why. Now we're going to take a short break and then come back with more of your thoughts about what Zach Polanski has been saying about drugs. The leader of the Green Party has reiterated his backing for the legalization of drugs. What do you think about that? 0345 60 60 973.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
We've had migration mathematics from Shabana Mahmood, but do her numbers add up?
The numbers as of today, we've had 350 people come into the country from France and 281 have been removed.
And a channel crisis made in China.
60% of crossings last year had engines that were Chinese made at their heart.
And a prime minister hoping for a pole swing after his work in Beijing.
China is a vital player on the global stage, and it's vital that we build a more sophisticated relationship.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast, back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
It's time to scale up that fishmonger business, and with free day-to-day online banking from Virgin Money, you'll be a big fish in no time. Now that's a real catch of the day. Open Virgin Money's M account for business now. UK excludes NI, Channel Islands and Isle of Man. 18 plus fees apply for chaps and international payments. Terms and exclusions apply. Backed by the current account switch service. Virgin Money is a trading name of Clydesdale Bank PLC.
Hiya, Kenny the Hamster here, beloved pet of Doug and Carol Brookbank. Now, I've got to hand it to Doug and Kazza. They're doing school pickups, jobs, trips to the supermarket and still find time to get healthy. Apparently, it's down to some NHS Healthy Choices quiz. Only took them 5 minutes to do, then gave them a simple plan to get started.
Come on, kids.
Total amazeballs!
Take your first little step to healthy. Search NHS Healthy Choices quiz to get a score and a plan that's right for you.
On your marks, get set, go hybrid. The new Toyota Aygo Cross Hybrid. More oomph than a Friday feeling. And smoother than your last online date. More confidence, more go. In a new hybrid engine with 0% APR representative over 24 months. The new Toyota Aygo Cross Hybrid. Go on. Visit your local Toyota centre. Price from £21,595. Available on Toyota PCP when financed through Toyota Financial Services by 31st March 2026. Optional final payment indemnities may be required. See website conditions apply.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun. All wobbly, all wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxed.
George is up the river cam without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby. Download the Thames Link Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel on off-peak journeys. Thames Link Railway, where every stop is a story.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 60 60 973.
So the Green Party leader, Zach Polanski, thinks that we are about time, overdue, in fact, for the legalisation of drugs. There needs to be a system change on drugs policy. As you would expect, the government has said no, 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 no. Hazelmere, hello, Robert.
Oh, hi, Nick. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I'd just like to say I'm a very late comer to LBC, and I've used Radio 4 to try and get myself to sleep for years and years and years. And I switched over to LBC for the Sitsa Chat radio, and I very much enjoy the weekend when you're on.
Well, welcome along. Thanks.
Yes. Now, I don't have a great deal of experience with drugs, apart from alcohol and cannabis, and I don't drink alcohol anymore, but when I was young, obviously I had on occasion excessive use of it, and I came across, I never really had anything to do with cannabis either, because I was rather square when I was young, but I came across it when I met a young Australian chap who used to grow a few plants, and he smoked it. And I became very interested in cannabis, not necessarily the high THC drug, but cannabis, the plant, and what a wonderful plant it is.
It's remarkable. Yeah,
absolutely fantastic.
There's not much it can't do. You make rope, clothes, milk. It's incredible.
Well, I believe Henry Ford built a car out of it. I think it can be turned into plastics and you can use it as fuel. I'm not quite sure. I didn't read this remarkable book about it. Oh. I believe when the Americans criminalized marijuana, which was smoked principally by, I think, the black population, suddenly the usage of marijuana went up, you know, threefold or whatever. It just increased. As soon as something is decriminalized, it appears to have this, greater demand for it. I believe that prohibition didn't do much for alcohol in America. But I do believe it should be legalized. I mean, the whole trade, the policy we have in every other country about criminalizing it has not worked. It hasn't reduced drugs coming into this country at all, or anywhere else for that matter.
No, I mean, I would go back to what I said to my guest at the top of the hour. If it is a war on drugs, well, you know, the war is over, drugs won.
Absolutely, but how much better it would be. I mean, tobacco is controlled now, and we're warned about how terrible it is. I mean, I've never smoked, because I saw a film at school with a picture of a blackened lung and everything. You know, it put me off, because I'd rather be healthy, you know. But I think if... I don't know about all the other drugs, but if they did come in and they were controlled and tested, and then there was warnings, I mean, I think along with legalization should come a lot of education about it as well. But I mean, my concern really is in South America, where these, you know, appalling things go on. People are dying as a result of drugs for the... You know, the smart people in London were aware of taking cocaine or something.
Yes, but they're dying specifically because it is illegal. If it were legal, then they wouldn't be fighting each other for turf any more than organised crime fights each other for yoghurt. You know, you can go to a shop and you can buy it, and it's no problem. So there's no criminal element to it. So it would take the criminals out of it, and I'm sure criminals would just concentrate on something else. But at least if somebody was going to take drugs, they would know, if it were legalized and regulated, they would know what they were taking before they took it. Now you've got no idea.
No, absolutely. And the farmers could grow it, then it could be traded, and then, you know, the government could tax it.
Well, yes.
And then possibly the use would go down.
Well, that is the evidence from places that have decriminalised drugs, that rather than the drug use going up, all of the evidence from everywhere that they've looked suggests that there is either no significant long-term surge in drug taking, or drug taking has actually gone down. Thanks for that, Robert. Portugal is the perfect example for this. They're the first country to decriminalise or to remove criminal penalties for personal possession of any drug. This was in 2001. And 25 years later, drug deaths in Portugal remained below the EU average, which would include us, because I think when we were in the EU, we were one of the worst. Rates of drug use have remained consistently below the EU average in Portugal. So it had the opposite effect to what the fearmongers are suggesting, that, you know, you decriminalise something and everybody's going to start taking it. The reverse appears to be true. See if I can squeeze one more in. Gwent, hello, Patrick.
Hiya, Nick. How are you, mate?
Good, thanks.
Right. I was going to say, right, I think that you should definitely legalise cannabis. And I'll tell you why. I've been smoking cannabis now for, I don't know, 30 years, say, right? And I would love nothing more than to be able to go into a dispenser in my local town tomorrow or whatever and say, hello, I have epilepsy and so on, and one thing and another. And then say, right, have a try of this, you know, because you can get vapes, you can get edibles and so on. I don't smoke tobacco no more, but I do smoke cannabis. And I think it would take all this stigma away. And I know people say all about the smell and all that, but look, everywhere you go, you smell the green, no matter where you are.
Right. I mean, cars smell pretty bad, but nobody's suggesting that we get rid of them.
Exactly. And, well, that's my opinion anyway. Look, right. I don't want to keep you because you're a busy man.
Okay.
And anyway,
that's very kind. Thanks a lot, Patrick. Cheers. One text to finish on that topic. Mark says, as a medical cannabis patient with a prescription for it, I still can't believe why successive governments are so intransigent on legalising it. Starmer is just the same as the rest, protecting Big Pharma. It's not exactly like we don't need the tax revenue. That's right. Now, coming up after the news, the Royal Parks are installing three new pedestrian crossings around Regent's Park to curb speeding cyclists. This adds up to a total of 8 sets of traffic lights on the Regent's Park circuit, which could put cyclists off from using their local park. In recent years, there have been several accidents between pedestrians and cyclists, so is this kind of thing something that you would appreciate? Or are we being too harsh on cyclists, when instead we should be encouraging people to get on their bike? Is Britain cycle-friendly? 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight. Peter Mandelson has resigned from the Labour Party to avoid causing it further embarrassment over his past friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. Documents released in the US include claims the late paedophile paid $75,000 into accounts linked to the former business secretary. Lord Mandelson says he does not recall getting the money 20 years ago. He'd said previously his friendship with Epstein had been a most terrible mistake. The cabinet minister, Steve Reid, told LBC on Sunday morning he should testify to Congress in Washington on his dealings with Epstein.
With the latest revelations, allegations, whatever you want to call them, we really do need to understand what's gone on. And they're disturbing to look at. I feel the same way as other people will feel when they saw that picture of Peter Mandelson in his underpants, so when he's telling us he doesn't know anything about what's gone on. Well, let's have some honesty. I've already said people should come forward if they have information to share. I hope he'll reflect on that.
The Shadow Home Secretary has told LBC Andrew Mountbatten Windsor should be removed from the royal line of succession. Chris Philp's been speaking after new calls from the Prime Minister for the King's brother to testify to Congress about his links with Jeffrey Epstein. The political and constitution historian Nigel Fletcher has been telling LBC Andrew should also help the authorities in Washington.
It's very clear from the photographs we've seen and from everything else that even if he has committed no crime whatsoever himself, he is clearly a witness. And so he's somebody who should be providing assistance to law enforcement agencies and indeed any other body, whether that's the US Congress or anyone else, who wishes to investigate this issue.
Andrew has consistently denied any wrongdoing. The Foreign Secretary says the UK will help to bring about more jobs in Ethiopia as part of efforts to stop its people from crossing the English Channel in small boats. Yvette Cooper's been visiting the country. She's signed a job creation agreement worth £292 million. International oil prices appear to be falling over hopes of a diplomatic solution to the row between the US and Iran over its nuclear program. They've dropped by more than $1 a barrel in Tokyo. President Trump has said Iran has been seriously talking with Washington. And an investigation has begun in the southwest following the deaths of two people. A woman in her 70s was found dead in Torquay on Saturday afternoon. The body of a man in his 40s was also discovered at Hythe near Southampton. LBC weather, cloudy with rain clearing to the southeast overnight. Clear spells for Wales, Northern Ireland and the southwest, meaning icy patches could develop. We'll see a low of around 3 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
The Times reporter Mark Ludlow wrote an article about what it is to be a cyclist in London. It starts, cycling has never been easy in London, from fighting for a space for cars and buses to dodging pedestrians who cross the street without looking. It's always been a white-knuckle experience. Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London, has introduced measures to make the city more cycle-friendly, including 20-mile-an-hour speed limits for cars in the centre of the city and the creation of dedicated bike lanes. This has made a difference. However, it remains a constant battle for cyclists to find a place for a decent ride for exercise in a city of 10 million people. Well, let's talk about this and the related issues with Donica McCarthy. Donica is a co-founder of Stop Killing Cyclists campaign and joins us on the line now. Hello, Donica.
Good evening, Nick.
Is Britain cycle-friendly?
Oh, gosh, absolutely not. You're right, London has become significantly better under Sadiq Khan, but nationally it's been a bit of a disaster. Something like 2% of English kids cycle to school. That compares to 67% in Holland. And one of the main reasons for that is for the last 30 years, after the Dutch parents demanded their government make the road safer for their kids, the government started investing real money in cycle infrastructure. In the UK, we're spending something like a hundredth of what the UN says we should be spending. So therefore, outside of London, it's a no-go area for many cyclists.
I've seen what they do in Holland, and much of it is separate lanes for cyclists, separate lanes for cars, trams. If they've got them, they get their own lanes. Everybody is split apart. Is that the kind of thing you would like to see here?
Yeah, because the surveys show that significant numbers of people, whether women or men, do want to cycle. They know it's good for their health, but a lot of them are afraid of cycling and sharing the road with HGVs and buses. So to deal with that perception of danger, it's crucial we have the infrastructure. The phrase that they use is build it and they'll come. And that's exactly what's happened in London. We campaigned for the first two major cycle lanes in London, and those are now being used by 3.5 million people a year. It's amazing. It really does show if you put in the infrastructure, the people will come, and we'll have a healthier climate, healthier population, and tackle congestion, because every single cyclist that uses a bicycle instead of a car is a car off the road.
Yes, the change in London has been remarkable. London used to be completely jammed with stationary cars and vans for most of the main part of the day. And then it all changed, and everybody was suggesting that, or people were complaining that, if you start putting in bike lanes and you make what used to be a two-lane road into a one-lane road, then the congestion is just going to get much, much worse. But it, to my eyes, the opposite happened. Is that right?
Well, if you persuade people to use a bike instead of a car or a cab, then that actually means that you're actually creating space for the rest of the traffic. I mean, one of the statistics that really blows my mind away is that now there's 1.5 million people taking a trip a day. taking it 4.5 million bike trips a day in London. That compares to 4.5 million by the tube at a tiny fraction of the cost. It's incredible. The bike lanes are the bicycles are now carrying something like a third to a quarter of the traffic on the underground. Isn't that incredible?
It is remarkable, yes. Has that gone up since COVID, when people didn't really want to be all hugger-mugger?
It's gone up, well, last year went up 13% to between 24 and 25. And I think since Sadiq Khan started investing after the campaigns to get the Boris and Sadiq to build them, I think it's gone up by something like 49%. But still a long way to go. There's still loads of people in London who are in parts of London where they don't have cycle lanes yet and who do want to cycle. And so therefore, nationally, what we are saying needs to happen to make Britain a cycle-friendly nation is we need to invest at the same level as modern European countries are investing in separate infrastructure. But secondly, we need to tackle the technical issues around cars. I don't know if you know, it's illegal for an e-bike. E-bikes have to be designed that they can't go over 15 miles an hour.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I've got an e-Brompton, and once it hits 15 miles per hour, the motor has to kick out. And so we think the same should happen to cars, not that the motor should kick out, but actually that there should be the technology is now in place that will prevent drivers from going over the speed limit. We think if that's sensible for cyclists, surely it's sensible for drivers as well. That's what's something that would really save lives.
What is sensible for car drivers, of course, is that they are easily identifiable by their number plate. Cyclists aren't. So should there be concurrently some sort of method of identifying cyclists?
That would make sense if the danger from a cyclist was the same as the danger from a car. But you're talking about 2,300 times percent more dangerous. To do that, to make a cyclist identifiable, you would have to have a license plate on every single bicycle, and the cost of that would be mind-blowing. And actually, if you think about the actual number of people being killed by cyclists, it's tiny compared to those killed by cars. I did a calculation just before the show. In the last 15 years, there's been, 23,000 people killed by drivers. There was one person killed by a cyclist red light driving. So what that would mean is that you have to stand at a junction in central London for 4.3 billion hours for the odds of seeing somebody killed by red light cycle jumping. 4.3 billion hours.
There is no doubt.
It's infinitesimally low.
Well, yeah, that may be, but you can still be, seriously injured by some 15-stone hulk bearing down on you at 20 mile an hour. You know, it's quite relatively easy to cycle without battery assistance at 20, and that's easily fast enough, and the thing is heavy enough with somebody on it to cause, injuries up to and including death. And would you dispute that cyclists pay less attention to the rules of the road than cars?
I will accept that cyclists break the red lights, but I would also say drivers break the red lights. If you want the difference between a cyclist breaking the red lights and a driver breaking the red light in a two-ton car is that they're 2,300% more dangerous, more lethal. The stats on drivers breaking the law is 3% drink drive, 9% admit video calling, 12% use their phones all the time, 40% use their phones occasionally, 50% break the 30-mile-per-hour limit, and 85% break the 20-mile-per-hour limit. So if we're going to... we should have enforcement of the law for everybody, but I argue should be proportionate to the lethality and the number of people being killed, and that means the vast majority of enforcement needs to be on drivers.
Yes, well, it is, of course, because for the reasons that we've already discussed, it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to enforce the rules of the road on cyclists because, you know, they're invisible to speed cameras. There's no way of identifying them. This is just off the top of my head. Could there be some sort of lawful bib of some kind, some sort of, those luminous jackets that builders wear, which would have the advantage of making them more visible, because the amount of cyclists I see in the middle of the night with no lights and they're wearing black clothing, with the expectation of arriving home alive, it seems very unlikely to me, but it would actually increase their visibility and make them more identifiable.
I think if you want to protect lives, the main thing you need to do is to actually build a separate infrastructure. You need to invest in infrastructure. If you want to tackle technically the deaths and injuries on a road, then the vast majority of the enforcement needs to be on tackling the fact that people can drive lethal vehicles when they're drunk or when they're speeding. We have the technology to stop that. Why can't we focus on that? I find this really interesting, Nick. If you look at the media, if you look at the right-wing tabloids and newspapers, they're constantly demonizing cyclists, constantly trying to demand more laws, more insurance, more registration. And they're doing the opposite for drivers. They're demanding less enforcement, higher speed limits, and no technology to protect. And yet they talk about a war on drivers. I would argue the war is on kids. And it's by these papers constantly trying to eliminate the laws on enforcement on drivers and constantly demonizing sites. I don't know why they're doing it.
Well, I have
it's
an
a
idea.
War on our kids.
I have an idea. I think those very same newspapers are also the same ones that proselytize for the oil industry. And if there's one thing that a cyclist does not use, it's petrol.
Well, that's very much a conspiracy theory, but it is definitely true that all of those right-wing papers are campaigning for an oil-based economy and campaigning on behalf of the oil billionaires. It's absolutely outrageous.
I mean, there is a sense, though, I mean, over and above what we've talked about, perhaps that people are getting their sense from the papers that they read, but a lot of people think that cyclists are cowboys. They're thrill racers who don't obey any rules of the road, including stopping at red lights. They don't ride on the correct side of the road. They don't stick to speed limits.
I'm not saying that cyclists don't break the law. They do. What I am saying is that the issue is that the lethality is infinitesimal compared to a driver breaking the law.
Right.
The other thing I would also argue is that if we break the law, it's very visible. Whereas actually quite often, if a driver is drunk driving, if they're speeding, if they're on their phone, it's less visible because they're within a metal box.
Right.
Whereas a cyclist is very visible. Well, a bit also on the issue of red light jumping. As I said, one person has been killed in 15 years compared to 24,000. Have you ever heard any newspaper or TV program talk about red light jumping by drivers?
Not off the top of my head. I can't think of one, no.
Whereas over the last 10 years, I've been doing this work to campaign for safer roads for cyclists. I must do around 10 interviews a year on this issue. And yet, I've never, ever been asked to do a TV interview or a radio interview about drivers' red light jumping. Since 2010, 700 people have been killed at traffic lights by drivers red light jumping. One person killed by a cyclist doing that.
Yes.
Surely we should have far more coverage of how do we stop drivers red light jumping than we do cyclists.
I think being in a car makes you feel impervious. It makes you feel as though nothing bad could ever happen to you because you're in your own comfortable, heated, dry space. What do you think of hire bikes? Because to me, it looks as though people are going out to the pub, getting a bit tipsy, thinking, yay, that looks like fun, let's get on a hire bike. And then they sort of weave their way home.
Well, there's a hire bikes, some of them are electric, some are not. I'm kind of avoiding your question slightly. There is definitely a problem that people are suiting up their bikes to be electric motorbikes.
Right.
And I think that is a serious issue that I do. We would support enforcement on by the police because we think that's significantly dangerous. Having people on a bike at 35, 40 miles per hour is a relief, and they don't have any crash helmets, is lethal both for them and for other people on the road. So I think that is an issue that's emerging as the technology improves. Legally, a bicycle has to have a speed limiter, but people are actually changing that and actually changing them basically into motorbikes.
Mm.
And that's a real problem, I think, that does need enforcement by the police.
Yeah, Well, let me ask you another question on the same issue. I mean, do you think that there should be some sort of training for people before they, well, I suppose, get on any bike, but particularly these hire bikes, which are so heavy that I think that some London hospitals have a name for people who come in with broken legs. They call them Lime legs, after the Lime bikes that are, you know, those battery-equipped ones.
Sure. Well, if the problem is you enforce, if you require training before somebody can use a bicycle, you're going to absolutely radically reduce the number of people cycling. What does that do? It means that the health benefits are lost. One of the things that we do is the stats on road injuries are very visible. What's not visible is actually the huge lethal impacts of people not cycling, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
The University of Glasgow produced a report, which I kind of thought this can't be right, it's just extraordinary. They're saying that somebody regularly cycling, whether it's to work or to school or to the shops, they have a 40% reduction in risk of a whole range of major diseases, whether it's lung diseases, cancers, and heart diseases. If you discourage people from cycling by requiring them to train before they use a bicycle, bringing that bureaucracy, you're going to have a massive increase and invisible deaths and invisible diseases as a result. So we're talking about something like, I think the stats are incredible. Where is it? There's something like 6 million people in the UK suffering from asthma, and 4 million suffering from diabetes type 2. Huge consequence of our lack of fitness. 24% of adults are obese. Cycling is a magic pill for this that will radically reduce those deaths. So my problem is, yes, it sounds logical. The good news is that nearly every school in London has, every kid in London in every school is having cycle training funded by the mayor. I think that's good. That means that every single person in school, when they come out of school, if they do get on a Lime bike, they will have had cycle training.
Do they still have cycle proficiency tests?
Not so much proficiency tests as training. When I walk past my local school, I regularly see there is a cycle instructor teaching the kids how to cycle safely.
Uh-huh. Well, we've come a long way, as we described, particularly in London, making things better for cyclists and pedestrians, people who live on roads that have less cars on. What do you think could still be done?
Well, nationally, I would argue that the government should do what the government in Wales has done. They should bring an urban speed limit of 20 miles per hour for villages, towns and cities. That would make a huge difference. When Mayor Can brought it in central London, the number of pedestrians being hit by cars went down by 67%. The stats from Wales are really positive, but yet the national government is running a miles from it because they're just scared of what happened to the Welsh government, is that they'll be torn to bits by the tabloids.
Yeah.
It's just shocking that our tabloids are campaigning actively to make our roads more dangerous for kids.
Mm.
So that's the first thing I need. Second thing is we need a budget. The UN says we should have a budget of 6 billion. We currently are spending around between 300 to 400 million, tiny fraction of what the UN says. We said. And thirdly is the technical things I said. Our cars need to have black boxes and breathalyzers and speed limiters. Those three things would transform our roads and make them safer for our kids. I really feel, I don't know about you, Nick, but I mean, I live in central London. I live in Peckham, and in our local area, we have annually a street party, and the roads are closed. And suddenly the roads are full of kids. I didn't know there was kids lived on our streets.
I know
and
exactly.
And my heart breaks. I love seeing them out playing with each other without a care in the world. But I know for the rest of the time they're invisible. Why? Because we imprison them with our car culture.
Yeah.
It's got to stop.
Good talking to you, Donica. Thanks so much for that. Donica McCarthy, co-founder of Stop Killing Cyclists campaign. So what do you think? Should there be a cycling proficiency test for everybody before they get on a bike on our roads? Do you think we do enough to make cycling easier in this country? What about potholes? I mean, it's bad enough, the potholes with a car, but with a bike, I can't imagine it. Does that affect your ability or your desire to get on a bike? And what do you think of a blanket 20 mile an hour everywhere? I mean, everywhere in a built-up area. If it saves lives, why not? 0345 6060 973.
LBC.
At Signature, our award-winning care homes are where luxury, comfort and peace of mind come together. With locations across London and the Home Counties, we offer exceptional residential, nursing and dementia care within five-star surroundings that feature a wealth of amenities, including our new wellness studios. To find out how you can receive an exclusive £1,000 discount with our new inclusive pricing, book a visit now at signaturecarehomes.co.uk. Terms and conditions apply.
Come on, quick, we have to run.
What, wait, what? Run to where?
The mini sale event. Keep up.
What, huh?
The mini sale event. Savings across the range, even on the iconic Mini Cooper.
Whoa!
And that's on top of all existing offers.
Right, let's pick up the pace.
The mini sale event. Amazing offers to act fast on. 5th to the 9th of February at your local mini retailer. Applicable on new Mini orders placed during the sale event and registered by the 30th of June 2026. Visit mini.co.uk/sale event.
Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
We are talking about cycling in London. I think it's fair to say that cycling has been transformed in London from where it was to certainly 10, 20 years ago. There are cycle lanes in a lot of main roads now, and the lanes available to cars has been reduced because of that. But unless you can tell me otherwise, it looks to my eyes as though the amount of traffic on those lanes has decreased, and London is not totally jammed all day long like it used to be. And then there's the positive effects of people exercising and getting out and about and breathing fresh air and, taking the weight off a bit. And they're less polluting, they're less noisy, and et cetera, and so on. Where are you on this argument? Do you think that we have maybe given up too much of our roads to cyclists or not enough? Woolwich, Richard.
Oh, hello, Nick. Nick, I think you did a brilliant job in deconstructing that kind of very pro-cycle propaganda coming from that guy, because he kept, every time you were challenging him, he kept sort of saying, oh, and what about the cars?
Yeah.
But I think you've got to get back to the idea about, well, no, what about the cyclists? They're a law to themselves, and they're out of control. And I am a cyclist. I didn't learn to drive until I was in my mid-50s, and I was a cyclist for sort of like 40 plus years.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize what a complete menace I was, probably to cars in all that time, because for example, you're saying the council is saying, like, in the park area we put up more traffic lights, but the problem is that the cyclists just drive through traffic lights. I mean, around London they just do it ceaselessly. And I just want to say, I've got a family member who's blind. They have not been to London for 7 years because of these electronic bikes. 7 years they have not gone to London because they just put those bikes in the middle of a pavement and they drive through traffic lights.
There's certainly,
they are
there's,
menace.
There's certainly a problem with people parking them when they're finished, just sort of throwing them away, essentially, like a used Kleenex. It's like anywhere will do. So, yeah, that is...
Yeah.
And that's something that the bike companies know about, and they are promising us that they're doing something about that, yeah. But, you know, if you recognise that you were being a problem, which... From what you've said, I think that's what you said. Well, why didn't you change your behaviour?
Well, now I'm a car driver. I realise what a big problem I was. I think at the time, I didn't realise I was such a problem. And I think, therefore, what we need to do, I think we need to do a couple of things. The first thing we need to, that came out implicitly in your discussion. We need to differentiate between the electronic power and pedal power.
Hmm.
I'm not suggesting we put registration on, you know, on sort of like 7-year-old kids' bikes. But what I am suggesting is these kind of tampered electronic vehicles that go 30 miles plus on pavements, they are a complete and utter menace. And we need to... And they are being illegal.
Well, they're being used for crime. I mean, if you're going to get your phone snatched out of your hand, it's probably by somebody who's on one of those. But, of course, they have broken the law in the first place to fiddle with the bikes to make them go that fast. So I think bringing in another law is not going to affect those people because they're already outlaws. Interesting talking to you, Richard. Thanks for that. Epsom. Hello, Ricardo.
Hi, good evening. Do you know, I've been listening to, not the last gentleman, but the one before, the advocate for cycling.
Yeah.
And I was shocked. I mean, he's turning round and saying, let's not give cyclists, you know, cyclists don't need to have tests because it's going to put them off cycling. I mean, I work in London, and twice, one outside London Bridge and once outside the Bank of England, I have seen cyclists under lorries. Why? Because they have head-cancelling headphones on, noise-cancelling headphones on, because they go on the inside of lorries, because they're a law unto themselves. The previous caller, who I just got the back end of, was beginning to speak sense. I mean, you know, not only that, but e-bikes, e-scooters, and yet these people do not think the absolute damage that they are causing these car drivers, these lorry drivers, who are innocently then causing accidents because of, not through their own fault, because of the absolute stupidity and negligence of these cyclists.
Well, let's admit that stupidity and negligence is not restricted to cyclists. That's just people. And you can be stupid and negligent whether you're behind the wheel of a car or walking on the pavement or on a bike. If that's who you are, then it doesn't matter what you're driving or how you're locomoting, that you're going to be acting in an antisocial manner. But the truth is that cars kill people and bicycles tend not to. So there is that. And the slower a car driver goes by force, then the fewer people get killed by cars. I mean, that seems evident. 20-mile-an-hour zones reduce overall casualties by about 40%. And they reduce child casualties by 75%. So, you know, we can go on demonising cyclists, but it's the car drivers who are doing all the damage. But thanks, Ricardo. Barnett. Hello, Matt.
Hi, how are you doing? Thank you for taking my call. It's a great great subject. And I just want to give a narrative, Nick, about, you know, an ex-paramedic point of view, just to give something positive to put in, as opposed to, like, them and us. One of the things I was thinking about is that if we're using the roads together and they're built together to give us all the service that they pay, if they can't do some sort of identification for cyclists,
yeah,
not to be financed, but just so they can sort of like to have a an enforcement that you have to have a sort of registration on the bike or right, on the back. Then they could do something like they did with the pilot thing with the congestion charts. If they did like a perimeter around, this is my idea, do a perimeter around the central London, goes out for 5 miles. You give them plenty of notice, say this is an enforcement area to be registered on the system, so we can then identify how many people do register, and that registration then will cover an insurance, which is cheap insurance, if there is an accident. Most accidents do happen with cyclists that aren't reported because cyclists just bounce through and they disappear.
Right.
And I remember saying to a cyclist once that had hit somebody and he did stop to render aid. And he said to me, I said, well, why do they all do this? He said, because we can get away with it. This is why we're so powerful with our we want this, we want that. The cycle lanes, Nick, are there for cyclists, but then they move into general lanes.
Well, that is annoying. Yeah, if they're going to go to the expense of building a cycle lane, then you know, if you can, you're on a bike, you should use it. Yeah, Matt, I'm going to give you the last word on that. Thanks. It is 12:30. Still to come in this hour, we are going to check in with our US correspondent for the latest from there and also see what the weather is going to be like as we head into the last month of winter. 12:30, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
Peter Mandelson has resigned from the Labour Party, saying he wants to avoid causing it further embarrassment over his past friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. Documents released in the US include the claims the late paedophile paid $75,000 into accounts linked to him. Lord Mandelson says he doesn't recall getting it. The Foreign Secretary says the UK will help to bring about more jobs in Ethiopia as part of efforts to stop its people from crossing the English Channel in small boats. Yvette Cooper has signed a job creation agreement worth £292 million. And international oil prices appear to be falling over the hopes of a diplomatic solution to a row between the US and Iran over its nuclear program. They've dropped by more than a dollar a barrel. barrel in Tokyo. LBC weather, cloudy with rain clearing to the southeast overnight. Clear spells in Wales, the southwest and Northern Ireland, which could lead to ice patches. We'll see a low of around 3 degrees.
LBC.
Business healthcare. Sounds pricey.
At Benenden Health, it's less than £16 per employee per month, which...
will go up when people use it.
Actually, no. We don't do price hikes each time our services are used. Just
medical questionnaires for everyone.
No. And it's quick and easy to join.
Sounds great. I'm in.
Benenden Health. Healthcare done different. Fee review periodically. T's and C's apply. Selected surgical procedures. Immediate access for businesses. Wait periods apply for personal membership. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
This time last year, Hassan was working in sales and spent his evenings gaming. Now, he's working as a prison officer.
You know what's going to happen, it's not worth it. Let's just go in there.
He's tackled cell fires, got through to some of the most challenging prisoners, and helped support their rehabilitation. He's done things he once thought he was never capable of, but he still loves his gaming. An extraordinary job done by someone like you. Search prison jobs now.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house, and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly. To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
At Pets in a Pickle, we know what it's like welcoming a new pet into the family. For fuss-free pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
The Met Office has issued another yellow weather warning, this time covering the southwest from midday on Monday to 9 o'clock on Tuesday morning. It just comes and it comes and it comes. Let's talk about this with John Hammond. John is a meteorologist and chief forecaster for the website Weather Trending. Hello, John.
Hi there, Nick.
It seems to be a particularly wet winter, this one. Is that just my misperception or is that true?
No, I mean, so far, so wet. You're absolutely right, particularly across certain discrete parts of the UK, particularly across the southwest of England, and that's where most of the flooding has been so far, especially through January. But other parts of the country as well have copped a lot of the wet stuff and some of the white stuff as well, which we'll probably go on to talk about. But focusing on the rain, first of all, yeah, we've had just a succession of weather fronts off a very strong jet stream powering into the more southern and western parts of the country, and then kind of grinding to a halt. And that's really been the ingredient which has brought such heavy and persistent rain to these parts of the country, because what we've had at the same time is that jet stream powering across the Atlantic. We've had a huge block of high pressure to our north and east, and that sort of stopped those weather fronts in their tracks, which has meant that the rain not only has been very heavy, but it's been persistent as well as those fronts have ground to a halt. And the totals just continue to pile up. The ground is completely saturated now across many southern and southwestern parts of the country. So any extra rain that we get now over the next few days and weeks, it won't take much for more flooding to occur. And it's going to be a combination of sort of flash flooding, but also just groundwater flooding, because that rain can't percolate into the ground, so it just sits on the surface, and flooding happens much more easily than it would do if there was some sort of if there was some ability for the ground to absorb the rain. Then we wouldn't see so much in the way of flooding. But I fear, looking at the weather charts, Nick, over the next several days, that flooding is almost inevitable across some of those areas which have been so badly affected over the last few days.
Yeah, it's not just the ground that seems incapable of absorbing the water. It's a basic infrastructure. It doesn't seem to have been built for the kind of weather that we're experiencing now. I mean, we think of Britain as, you know, perpetually grey and raining, but it's much more wet than it used to be. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, you're right in both respects. I think our infrastructure is less able to cope with the amounts of rain which we sort of historically get in the winter months. And that's because, you know, we're being forced to build on floodplains. And floodplains are called floodplains for a reason. They flood. And with the pressure on new housing, and over the last 20 or 30 years, we have built on areas which, you know, over hundreds of years, people have known, you don't build a house there, it floods. But that's where we're at. Add to that the fact that, as you say, you know, we are seeing more excessive rainfall, and that's a signature of climate change, particularly in the winter. The message is that over the years to come, we're going to see wetter winters. We may see drier summers, and that's another problem, of course, but through the winter time, the signals from climate models is that we are going to see more intense rainfall. And that's another element of climate change, actually, is that when it does rain, Nick, that rain is heavier than it used to be, because for every degree of warming, you can add another 7% that the atmosphere can hold. So when it does rain, it rains a hell of a lot harder. So there's a combination of factors which is leading to this sort of, the same old story every winter, it seems, that, you know, come January and February, places are flooded out. And we've got, you know, a few more weeks of the winter to come, and a similar sort of setup meteorologically with, as I mentioned earlier, those weather fronts piling in off the Atlantic and then slowing and grinding to a halt, which means for those areas across the south and the west, I'm afraid I'm the harbinger of doom, because we're in for another wet week.
Oh, really? The effects of climate change are felt differently depending on where on the globe you are, of course. And I believe America is having a real storm.
Well, I mean, I've just been looking at some of the images and some of the stats actually across the states at the moment. You know, the most intense cold, or the most unusually intense cold, is across Florida. And here, you know, I'm seeing images of snow falling from the sky across, you know, the likes of Myrtle Beach in the Carolinas and down into Tampa. Not unheard of, but very unusual, Nick. And I'm fearful for, you know, the likes of the citrus crops, which, you know, are sensitive to severe frost. We are going to see severe frost across the southeastern states over the next few nights. So, that's going to have problems as we head into the spring, and to what extent the citrus fruits have been harmed. But more widely across the states, yes, we've had a plunge of Arctic air coming down, yep, from the north. That's showing signs of easing over the next few days, but only for a time. I think we could well see further plunges of intense cold coming in across the more northeastern parts of the states as we go through the week ahead. So, yeah, it is a story of extremes around the globe, particularly across the northern hemisphere at the moment, be it very wet weather in our neck of the woods, but very intensely cold weather across the states. Actually, one of the reasons we haven't had it so intensely cold across the UK over the last few weeks is because of that intense cold pushing down across the states, because what that has done is that's introduced a very, very strong temperature gradient across the Gulf of Mexico. When you get an intense temperature gradient, that charges up the jet stream, and it's that very strong jet stream which, as I say, has been hurtling across the Atlantic and producing that heavy rain for us. And another twist, Nick, whilst we've had very wet weather across the more southern parts of the UK, across the Highlands of Scotland, particularly the Grampians, we've got phenomenal amounts of snow here. Because whilst those fronts have ground to hold across southern parts of the UK, further north across the UK, we've had that feed of easterly winds off a very cold continent now. Cold air has been building up across Scandinavia and the more northeastern parts of Europe, and parts of Scotland have been tapping into that cold air, and at any elevation, we've seen a lot of snowfall, metres of snow now across the Cairngorms. Great news for the skiing industry.
Yeah.
And we're going to see metres more of snow, I fancy, in the week ahead, because, as I said, the general setup, the pattern over the next week or so is not going to be that dissimilar to how it's been over the last few weeks.
And everything that we've just talked about, all of the extremes from you know, one from drought to flooding, all predicted by climate scientists, but it's happening more quickly than they expected. Is that right?
I mean, I have to say that the climate models have been absolutely spot on in terms of the trajectory of warming we've seen over the last 20, 30, 40 years. You know, I'm old enough to remember, you know, the climate signals from way back in the 70s and 80s when I was at university. And they were indicating this degree of warming which has been accelerating over the last 10 or 20 years. So hats off to the climate models. They're doing exactly, or the weather's doing exactly what those models have predicted, more or less. There are some uncertainties. And one of those will be how the atmosphere responds to the marked warming which is taking place in the Arctic. This is what's called Arctic amplification. So that the greatest degree of warming is taking place in polar regions. And what that's doing is it's weakening the temperature gradient between the poles, the Arctic, and the mid-latitudes, which is where we live. And so how that will affect the jet stream in the decades to come is still a source of uncertainty amongst researchers. There's one school of thought which says it will actually intensify the jet stream. And there's another school of thought which says it will weaken the jet stream. If it weakens the jet stream, actually, that will allow Arctic air to leak out more easily. And some climate researchers are suggesting that what we're seeing right now with this intense cold coming down across North America, for example, and there's some intense cold down across some parts of Europe at the moment, that is a signature of this Arctic amplification, and that in the decades to come, we may well see some shots of really unusually cold air coming down into the mid-latitudes. I must say that that's only one school of thought. Another school of thought suggests that actually what we're more likely to see is a stronger jet stream, which will keep the colder air at bay. So it's tempting to sort of say, aha, look what's happening in North America with all this unbelievably cold weather. That's a sign that we're going to get more of this in the decades to come. I think it's foolhardy to attribute, you know, one weather event such as we're seeing at the moment and saying, right, well, that's the pattern we're going to see in the decades to come. It's not as straightforward as that. There's a lot of research going into how the jet stream will respond to a warming Arctic. So the jury's out on that one, Nick.
But our immediate future is a lot more rain.
It is certainly for the next several days. As I mentioned, more fronts piling in off the Atlantic, grinding to a halt, particularly across the more southern and central parts of England and Wales. This is where the weather warnings will continue to build up through the week ahead, and the flood warnings, I'm afraid. Meanwhile, it keeps on snowing across the Grampians. As I say, metres more snow here. And for a time later on this week, Nick, some of that cold air is going to creep southwards. So although the main story is all about the wet weather, don't be at all surprised wherever you are across the UK if you see some of the white stuff later on this week, particularly in the north and particularly up over the high ground. Winter's not over yet, and we could eventually see some much colder air coming in from the east. So that's one to watch. Most of us have escaped the really cold and snowy weather so far this winter. That may change as we go further on into February.
Very good to talk to you, John. Thanks for that. John Hammond, meteorologist, chief forecaster for the website Weather Trending. Now we're going to take a short break, and then it is off to America to talk to LBC's US correspondent Simon Marks.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Richard Spurr.
Zach Polanski said that we need a grown-up conversation about drugs, and a second woman's alleging that she was sent to the UK for a sexual encounter with the former Prince Andrew. But shouldn't we now just let him retire with dignity?
Richard Spurr at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
I'm Leah, and this is my NHS story. I could just feel my body didn't feel right, and my GP referred me to CDC. Had some blood tests done, and within 24 hours I had my results. And that just reassured me that I was being taken seriously.
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres, with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS Fit for the Future. Available England-wide.
This time last year, Hassan was working in sales and spent his evenings gaming. Now, he's working as a prison officer.
You know what's come out, it's not worth it. Let's just go in there.
He's tackled cell fires, got through to some of the most challenging prisoners, and helped support their rehabilitation. He's done things he once thought he was never capable of, but he still loves his gaming. An extraordinary job done by someone like you. Search prison jobs now.
What's the secret to feeling young? Cryo chambers? Vampire facials? Forest bathing? Really? The real secret to feeling young can be found in the new Seat Ibiza and new Arona.
Both have smart new looks and stylish new interiors. Plus, new alloy wheels and a 6-speaker sound system. Seat, Nolan Young.
At Pets in a Pickle, we know what it's like welcoming a new pet into the family. For fuss-free pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
Leading Britain's conversation, Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
LBC's US correspondent is Simon Marks, and he joins us on the line now. Hello, Simon.
Evening, Nick.
I believe there's big news from the prestigious Donald Trump YMCA FIFA Kennedy Center for Dad Dancing.
Absolutely breathtaking news that the President of the United States has just announced within the last few minutes over his social media feed. Remember the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts?
Yes.
One of the world's leading arts institutions that since 1971, when it opened as a living memorial to the assassinated President John F. Kennedy, has been a home for some of the world's leading artists, performers, musicians, dancers, until, of course, Donald Trump affixed his name to the Kennedy Center without any congressional approval, as is legally required. So it's now called the Trump Kennedy Center, to the fury of the Kennedy family. Well, within the last few minutes, Donald Trump has announced it's going to close for 2 years from July the 4th of this year. He says that after a one-year review of the Trump Kennedy Center, he has decided that if the building is temporarily closed for construction, revitalization and complete rebuilding, it can then become the finest performing arts facility of its kind anywhere in the world. In other words, he says, if we don't close, the quality of construction will not be nearly as good, and the time to completion, because of interruptions with audiences from the many events using the facility, will be much longer. He insists the temporary closure, temporary for 2 years at least, will produce a much faster and higher quality result. Now, those are the false alternative facts that are being trafficked by the president. This evening. The reality is that since the complex was renamed the Trump Kennedy Center, audiences have eschewed it. Performers have dropped out in droves. Only last week, the composer Philip Glass yes. announced that he wasn't going to allow his new symphony to be premiered at the Kennedy Center later this year. The entire cast of Hamilton has pulled out. The Washington Ballet has pulled out after having based themselves at the Kennedy Center since it opened in 1971. They're upping sticks and taking off. And if you actually look, and I was looking at this a few days ago, at the calendar for what's on at the Kennedy Center, I mean, there is very, very little on for the summer season that is coming up. And so what Donald Trump has done is decided that in the face of this abject disaster with performers pulling out and musicians pulling out and dancers pulling out and composers pulling out and audiences staying away, he is now going to close this country's premier performing arts complex for at least the next 2 years, and presumably engage in some kind of reconstruction that I would imagine is going to make it be similar to the demolition of the East Wing of the White House. And just to be clear, this is a gorgeous facility. I mean, there's nothing they need to do to it. It is in tremendous shape. It's not that old. It, as I say, opened in 71. Lick of paint here, bit of new molding there, and they'd have it fixed up. This is a fit of pique by the Philistine in chief who is governing this country. And I think that it's going to have devastating impact, particularly here in Washington, D.C. But I think there's huge questions, of course, for Republicans in Congress, because it is a congressionally funded facility, and he doesn't actually have the right to do this. So are they going to stand up along with the quislings that he's placed on the board? I believe Melania is the chairman of the board now. And it was only a few weeks ago that he said he was surprised when the board had honored him by naming the complex after him.
Wow.
And members of the Kennedy family said they would be standing by with a pickaxe to remove his name from the exterior of the building as soon as he left the presidency. Yeah. So that's the breaking news from here tonight.
And that that Philip Glass piece was going to be a premiere of his new piece about Lincoln.
Right, so exactly.
I'm sure that Trump wouldn't have liked to have been, you know, upstaged by a better president.
Well, look, they just can't fill the center with acts. I mean, they've put this zealous Trump supporter, Rick Grenell, in charge of the place. It was only last week that they appointed a new director who was going to be responsible for booking acts. I forget the title of this guy, but they brought some fella in from the West Coast who they said was going to be responsible for bringing premier acts to the Kennedy Center. Now, why on earth would you have made that appointment if you truly thought you were going to keep this complex if you truly thought you were about to close the complex?
Yes.
So they've obviously come to the conclusion very quickly that they just can't book sufficient stars that are ever going to put bums on seats in that vast theatre. I mean, even he attended the premiere of Melania the second time he went to see it, the film, the other night at the Kennedy Center. And even there, they struggled. I mean, they obviously frog-marched every single Trump supporter in town they could find into the building. And the pictures showed that there were all sorts of empty seats throughout the auditorium. So, I mean, but it's a tragedy for Washington, D.C., this. And particularly for visitors, because the Kennedy Center, of course, has been a magnet, like the Smithsonian Museums in the center of the city, where he's ordered an audit of every single artifact and exhibit to make sure that it aligns with his own personal view of history. I mean, he is laying waste to the cultural landmarks in this city.
But at least Melania is showing at some locations near you, and tickets are still available.
Tickets are still available, but, you know, it's done better than I think many people imagined that it might. Suspiciously well.
I don't believe this story. I think this is fake news.
It looks like they brought in about $7 million in opening weekend ticket sales.
Right.
Which is apparently unprecedented for a documentary, if indeed one truly considers this film a documentary. And to be fair, I should say I have not yet seen it. I am
not
planning
yet
to go.
Are you? Really?
Well, I've decided it's sort of my professional duty to go and see it. Yeah, right. I've been mulling it over, but
it's,
I've decided
tax deductible.
My professional. Yeah, I'll do it on expenses. I'll go and see it. So they brought in $7 million over the weekend. Now, bear in mind, you know, Amazon spent $40 million making it. I mean, a lot of which, of course, went to Melania,
yes,
because she's not only the star, but she's the executive producer. They then, sensing that it was not going to do very well, ploughed another $35 million into trying to get lots of advertising and try and pregame the outcome of all of this. But you know, for Amazon and Jeff Bezos, this was never about the money that he was spending on the documentary. It was about the favor that he was buying in the court of Trump by giving the first lady something to do.
Yes.
And not just this film, by the way. This is just the start. There's a five-part docu-series that will follow, apparently, for Amazon. No. There's more of it.
About Melania.
About Melania, that she will be completely heading up and starring in and, you know, her life as first lady.
Well,
strap yourself in.
No, I won't. I keep a Trump bingo card going on my Friday and Saturday shows. And the latest thing to get the entry this year is Trump is going to demand a documentary about him.
Well, I know it's a Sunday, but I'll put on your bingo card that the five-part docu-series is never made in full.
Right.
How about that?
Okay. let's talk about this poor kid, this five-year-old child who got arrested in his own driveway and was used as bait to get his dad out by Trump's ICE goons. And a local judge said, you must release this five-year-old child immediately. Of course you must. And the ICE goons ignored it and sent him to Texas, which was a completely different state. What's happened now?
the whole... Well, now, the father and the five-year-old have been ordered to be released from detention in Texas, and they have been flown back to Minneapolis and reunited with the family. The story is on its face a disgrace, and it underscores the fact that ICE and the Border Patrol are basically operating as the personal paramilitary forces of the President of the United States and constantly violating court orders, to the point where the chief judge in Minnesota last week said that in the space of January alone, he thought it was likely that ICE had violated more court orders than any other federal agency has violated in its entire existence. This five-year-old, Liam Conejo Ramos, and his father, Adrian, were taken into custody when ICE made a targeted effort to pull the father in as a suspected illegal immigrant. But he was driving home from school with the five-year-old in his car. They pulled into the driveway, and immediately ICE set on them. The father made a run for it. The ICE agents then used the five-year-old. They used a five-year-old boy as bait to try and get the mother, who was inside the house, to come out so that they could detain her as well. And remember that they're not allowed legally to enter a home without an arrest warrant, although they've been doing that all over the country for many, many weeks now. The mother refused to come out. ICE held onto the kid. They caught the father, and they took the five-year-old and the father and put them on a plane and sent them to Texas and were preparing to deport them. Now, when they were arrested, this family was in the process of going through immigration hearings to see whether they could win permission to stay in the United States. So the judge in the case has said, well, hang on a second, they're in the middle of that process. You can't interrupt that. You've got to free the kid. You've got to free the father. They go back to Minneapolis and they remain in that legal process. So there were very touching scenes today. The little boy was allowed by the pilots of the plane that brought him home into the cockpit of the plane. And they made a big, you know, a big deal of that and gave him a chance to, you know, play with the controls and yes. Play, not obviously not before the plane took off, you know, and they gave him the cockpit experience. And
even
treated him like
even
a,
though that 5-year-old child is a terrorist maniac.
I mean, it's just, or as Kristi Noem, the Secretary of Homeland Security, described protesters and illegal immigrants in the United States. She described them today as violent monsters, which, by the way, gives you a sense that when Donald Trump said earlier in the week that he was going to de-escalate things in Minneapolis, and there were all of these reports that the White House was softening its tone towards ICE and Border Patrol operations, as Donald Trump himself, 24 hours later, then said he hadn't meant it, and they don't mean it, and things are as hazardous, I think, on the streets of Minneapolis and other cities in terms of the safety of not only illegal immigrants, but American citizens who are participating in protests and legal acts of observation, as they were when Alex Pretty was killed and as they were when Renee Good was killed in January.
Well, I think you should go to a safe space. I think the safest place is probably at a screening of Melania. There won't be anybody else there. Simon?
Go and hide out there.
Yes. All the best. Thanks for that. Simon Marks, LBC's Washington correspondent. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the LBC app, where you can also stay up to date with the latest news and videos and opinion. You can download the LBC app. It is free. Get it at your app store now. I'll be back Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Ian Payne. But first, Richard Spur.
Nick, and good morning to you. There needs to be a change on drugs policy. Green Party leader Zach Polanski has said as he reiterated his backing for legalisation. But do you believe that some illicit drugs should be made legal in the UK? First, though, a second woman is now alleging that she was sent to the UK by Jeffrey Epstein for a sexual encounter with Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. The encounter allegedly occurred at the former prince's mansion, Royal Lodge, in 2010. The woman, who is not British, was in her 20s at the time. She says she was also given a tour of Buckingham Palace and tea. So this morning, as more accusations mount against the late Queen's favourite son, what should be done with this troublesome former prince? When you call 0345 6060 973.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the Conservatives say Peter Mandelson is now completely disgraced after resigning from the Labour Party over his friendship with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. The peer and former British ambassador to Washington has stepped down following the release of more Epstein files in the US on Friday. LBC's Thomas Watts has been looking at the comments from him.
He's used his resignation letter to say, "I have been further linked this weekend to the understandable furore surrounding Jeffrey Epstein, and I feel regretful and sorry about this. Allegations, which I believe to be false, that he made financial payments to me 20 years ago and of which I have no record or recollection, need investigating by me."
The Prime Minister says the UK will look into working with the EU on defence. Sir Keir Starmer says it may apply to join a multi-billion euro fund for military projects. The European Commission is considering the launch of a second edition of its safe loan scheme. President Trump has responded to warnings about regional stability from Iran's supreme leader by saying he hopes to reach an agreement with Tehran. The two nations are at odds over the Gulf state's nuclear program. A major buildup of Washington's forces has developed in the region. But the former senior advisor had